It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Jeff Jarvis is here. Kevin Toefel filling in for Stacy. We will take a look at Mary Meeker's annual slideshow, 333 slides. We'll pick our favorites. It's really kind of some interesting trends on the internet. The New York Times got it all wrong about Google News. Jeff will explain. The Pixel 4 has been leaked. And we finally figured out who Stadia is for. It's all coming up next on Twig.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twig.
This is Twig, This Week in Google, episode 512, recorded Wednesday, June 12th, 2019. That's a lot of Baldur's Gate. This Week in Google is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Protect your online privacy with one click. It's that easy. For 3 extra months free with a 1-year package, go to expressvpn.com/twig. And by WordPress. Turn your dreams into reality and launch your website at wordpress.com. Get 15% off any new plan purchase at wordpress.com/twig. And by Capterra. Find the right tools to make an informed software decision for your business. Capterra is software selection simplified. Visit Capterra's free website at capterra.com/twig. It's time for Twig This Week in Google. Oh, we got a lot to talk about today. Let's kick this thing off. Jeff Jarvis is here. He is the director of the Townite Center for Entrepreneurial Journalism at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. And he's mad as hell, and he's not going to take it anymore.
Buzz Machine. I don't know what I'm mad about yet, but
have you seen Network yet with Bryan Cranston? Oh, I guess it closed.
No, I haven't.
You missed it.
I didn't make it.
You know, Colleen here in our office, our supervising producer, saw The Last Night.
Ooh.
She says it was really good. I said, shut up.
I'm so jealous. Yeah.
That's Kevin, the chortle of Kevin Toefel, the Toefel chortle from aboutchromebooks.com, and of course, co-host on the IoT podcast with Stacy.
My Chrome hero.
And his Yay. Chrome hero. That's Yay. Nice.
That's my
nice.
Goal in life, Jeff, is to be your Chrome hero.
And you've succeeded.
You are the wing beneath his trackpad. The wind. So, Jeff, I thought I'd start with your that New York Times story.
I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Your response. Right. It was kind of weird that New York Times just printed what is essentially a press release.
Oh, without any conflict of interest up the yin yang for its own industry. But you should explain it first.
Headline, Google made $4.7 billion from the news industry in 2018, study says. And the study, of course, is from the News Media Alliance.
Formerly the Newspaper Association of America. They finally changed their name.
Yeah. And it comes from, I think, a false premise, which is that when Google shows snippets from news articles in its search results, the money it makes from those ads, Google should give some of that to the newspapers.
It gets worse and worse. They presume that the value is in the snippet, or as I said in the post I wrote, that it's as if you take one sentence of theirs, it's like a camera taking a picture and stealing the soul of a native. You've taken all the value out, right? And so that's problem one. So obviously, all the value is the opposite. So it argues at length, see all these ways that Google's gotten more interested in news. They're doing more news and more news and more news. That's all good for the news industry.
Yeah, because
it sends more traffic to news people, right?
As you point out, every month, this is from Google's statement, they're talking about the $4.7 billion. These back-of-envelope calculations are inaccurate, as a number of experts are pointing out. And really, that's true. After the Times published that, everybody jumped on. The overwhelming number of news queries do not show ads, number one. The study ignores the value Google provides. And this is, I think, the most important point. Every month, Google News and Search drives over 10 billion clicks to publishers' websites.
Now, let's add to that, Leo. That number is 8 years old.
Wow.
It is much higher now, but I couldn't get that number out of them now. I tried. Much higher now.
And we know because was it France? Was it Spain? Where did they cut off Google?
Spain.
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 and it killed traffic by 10 or 20%. It was a big flop.
Yeah. And then so the next fallacy of this whole thing. So the basic logic of it falls apart in the second paragraph. Google's paying more attention to news. They should pay us more. No, Google already is paying you more but giving you more traffic. All flawed from then on. But the real statistical travesty of this is they relied entirely on a 10-year-old offhand comment in some conference made by Marissa Meyer, remember her, where she was just trying to be nice to news and saying, yeah, we're not crazy to have news. You know, I don't know, it could be worth $100 million. So they used that and then extrapolated that and said, well, Google's grown this much. They used data from two publishers. So it's grown this much, ergo it's now worth $4.7 billion. The entire thing is flawed to flawed to flawed.
Now, normally I would just write that off as, well, New York Times, they're one of the newspapers, and this
they're in a conflict of interest.
Self-serving. But they're publishing this. They published a study on Monday because the House subcommittee on Tuesday having a hearing, and the News Alliance hopes... In fact, the director of the News Alliance said he hoped an outcome of any conversation generated by the study would be the passage of a bill, a law, the Journalism Competition and Preservation Act, which would give news publishers a 4-year antitrust exemption and allow them to collectively bargain with Google and other online platforms over revenue splitting. Because so if you go all together, it's collusion.
Right. And so they're arguing that Google's antitrust. So what's the cure to antitrust? More antitrust. It's all just ridiculous. And the real problem here is that it's – and I get in some trouble for criticizing publishers, and a lot of them do try, and editors do try, and this is really hard, and we don't have the answers. I don't have the answers. But this is not the answer. Protectionism is no strategy for the future. It's distracting from their real job, which is to serve the public and figure out new ways to do that. And you know what? Even if they got $4.7 billion and divided by all the members of the News Media Alliance, it's nothing. Nothing. There is no solution here. There is no answer here. Basically, the Americans are jealous that Europe has its European Copyright Directive with its horrible clauses. And I had just come from Google Newsgeist. Full disclosure, Google pays for the venue, the food, and a lot of drinks.
Isn't that ironic?
But we pay for our travel. I pay for my travel in Athens. Very nice, by the way. Great grilled sardines.
Ooh, we're going to Athens this fall. You'll have to give us the location.
Oh, I wish I knew more. I was there for 2.5 days. 20 minutes at the Acropolis. But I sat in a room filled with European editors and publishers who are scared S-less over what the copyright directive is going to do to them. Because they're sitting there in the room saying, well, this demands that Google licenses and pays for snippets. Google's saying, they ain't doing that. No way we're doing that. We didn't do it in Spain. We're not doing that. So then what's the extension of that? Does Google at some point not just pull Google News out, but do they say, we can't really put in snippets and decent links to news sites that haven't given us a license throughout search? So who suffers? The publishers suffer. The journalists suffer. The public suffers. Good work, industry.
Apparently there's bilateral support in Congress for this bill. Now, this doesn't mean they'll be able to make a deal.
Succeed, because the same thing is going to happen here. They're going to say, pay us, Google.
Right.
And Google's going to say,
no.
We already give you value.
Right.
And you publishers should be smarter about how to exploit those relationships. And they weren't. So what did Google do? Google came along and they created Google Subscribe with Google to make it really, really easy to subscribe instantly from Google Pages just because the publishers were too busy to figure out how to do this on their own.
They're busy. That's it. They're busy.
That was nice of me, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Google, I think Google takes 5% fee, something ridiculously little just to cover their costs. That's it. And they've been doing that. But the bigger issue here is that this is an example of what news publishers are doing to ruin the internet. And it's happening over and over and again. And, you know, it occurred to me, Leo and Kevin, that – so I appeared on MSNBC yesterday about this. And, you know, when the antitrust argument is made, the problem is that everybody now thinks that Google and Twitter are the internet. They're not. Though what you do to them, you do to the internet, which is an issue. But I sat there at an NBC studio and I said, Comcast is an internet company. AT&T is an internet company. Amazon's an internet company. Soon, the Washington Post and the New York Times will be internet companies. There's lots of internet companies out there. So when you talk antitrust, let's talk about the whole internet and all the functions of the internet. And I think it's hard to argue antitrust, but that's what's happening in Congress. And the result is publishers are using their political capital in conflict of interest, corruptly, knowing they have the clout they have, to attack not just Google and Facebook, but also the net itself and how it operates. And I have had it. I am mad as hell in my own damned industry. And I'm pissed. And I was far from alone. There were lots and lots of tweets and posts. So I was flying back from Athens. Like 10 minutes before I got on, I see tweets from my friends Aaron Pilhofer and Jay Rosen about this. Jay saying, you got to get on this. So I'm on the plane with the with 100 baud internet, trying to follow all these links and figure out what's what. And I spend most of the flight back from Athens writing this post because I'm just so pissed off at my own industry.
What was the outcome in Spain?
The outcome of Spain was that so I'll say it just because you love to hear me say it. In Germany, the Leistungsschutzrecht, the ancillary copyright, said that the publisher has to grant a license to allow the snippets. Publishers goes to Google and says, pay us for snippets. Google says, ha, kein Weg, no way. And so then publishers pulled out of Google for literally a few days, hurt like hell, came back and said, okay, uncle, put us back up. In Spain, there was no option for a free license. Spain decreed that the platforms must pay basically everyone in news that they quote.
That's another way to negotiate. Get the legislator to do it.
Well, what happened was Google said, we won't do it. We can't do it. No way. And thus they closed Google News in Spain. And there have been many reports since that this hurt especially small publishers. You know, the big guys in all of these discussions, Google and Facebook are the biggest publishers, the New York Times and the Washington Post, they can deal with a lot. But I sat at Newsgeist Europe, and there were small publishers there who are hurting already. And these things, when they come along, cause just huge surges in cost for them. Mm. So it reduces the diversity of the news ecosystem at the time when we need it most. And it's short-sighted, and it's anti-competitive, and it's stupid.
If Google decided to take snippets from our podcasts and push them in search results, I would
kiss their feet.
I would be so happy. Why wouldn't you be happy, right? Yeah. With a link to the show? And, I mean, it would be the best thing Google could ever do. I'm happy that they're even thinking about indexing the podcasts at all.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's a great example. That's a superb example of a parallel about how that's going to be extremely helpful to you. You get more involved in search. Yeah.
So it seems to me almost rent-seeking. Like, they think Google's rent-seeking. In other words, not adding value and asking for money. But, of course, they're not. It's really the other way around. Google's giving you value, and you're saying, well, you should pay us for the value you're giving us.
Yeah.
That's nutty. It's
discovery. I am one of those small publishers, very small publishers, and I just
My mind, Kevin. You're very big in my mind.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. About 35% of my traffic comes from Google News.
Wow.
That's not insignificant. Number one, and number two.
Wow.
I wonder, and Jeff, maybe you've seen a real study because I don't buy this any more than anybody else does. The one that we addressed earlier. Is there a study showing how many people maybe who don't subscribe to news sites but still go there as a result of Google News or Apple News or some other, you know, internet discovery mechanism? I'm guessing it's quite high.
Yeah, the problem with this is that you're kind of proving a negative. The contrary argument that's made is how many people just see the snippet and don't go? You're saying the opposite of that. How many do see the snippet and go? You don't know what they wouldn't have seen in a way. You know what I'm saying?
I go every day. That happens to me every day. I get a I look at a snippet and go to a story.
But yeah, absolutely.
I'm a very specific use case. So
yeah, but I mean, it is part of our you know, beat check. I go to Tech Meme and sites like it, yeah. Reddit, and I want to see
new
snippet.
Sources.
I see, like, here's Tech Meme with top tech news, right? It's got snippets. I want to see the snippets. It also has links to competing stories from other places.
You might prefer another brand.
Yeah, it has.
So Kevin
tweets, this is all good for everybody. This is, God, it just drives me nuts.
It's insane. Yeah. So Kevin, there was a study, somebody from a certain large company we happen to be discussing told me, but didn't have the details and didn't remember who it was from. So this is, take this with a grain of salt the size of Utah. Because I don't have the details, but did say that there was a study in Europe that valued the clicks. Now, I don't know. The problem is, since I can't see the study, I can't know at what level. Is it just new users? Is it any user? But in the range of like €4 to €5, for whatever definition that was, you know, there's a tangible value for a link. But the only way to exploit that link is if the publisher does so. And if the publisher is going to show you you know, junk links and 55 ads, then you're going to lose them. The publisher's job is to try to build a relationship with you and find your lifetime value. We're going to get to Mary Meeker's thing in a minute, but one thing that's emphasized is the customer acquisition cost. She said it goes up above lifetime value, and that's unsustainable. When you get somebody from Google, that is free customer acquisition. Free. That's where the value is.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's two issues. One is you don't want Congress to get involved in this because they're apparently just going, oh, okay. Maybe, I don't know, this newspaper alliance pays members of Congress money, but which would be unheard of, but probably the case. But also because there are reasons to be upset about Google and their monopoly, and there are things perhaps Congress should get involved with. This is not one of them. This is a special interest case that I don't think benefits anybody. It's stupid. By the way, I have to admire Google. Well played, sir. This morning I woke up to see images of a Pixel 4 phone from Unbox Therapy and other places. It was really, it's the usual leaks we get because the Pixel wouldn't come out till October. But the leaks we usually get around this time is they start putting out models for case makers, so it was that. And Google responded, the Made by Google Twitter feed, well, since there seems to be some interest, here you go. And they sent out actual pictures of the back of the Pixel 4, which I mean, that's the way to handle it. There's still lots of things they didn't tell anybody. There's no way to know if there's a headphone jack. We're not seeing the front of it, so we don't know what kinds of affordances there are. And you can only see one button. So there's a lot of question marks. What a great way to handle a leak like that. I've never heard of any company doing that. Yeah.
And that's kind of a nice exchange there with Marcus Brownlee.
Yeah, he says, at least let me drop my Dream Phone 2019 video first.
And Google responds,
the year's not over. pretty good, Google. Well played. It also makes me wonder if maybe October is not the date. That's when they've released the previous Pixel phones. Maybe they're thinking, since they announced, well, I guess it would still make sense to do it later in the year. They just announced the Pixel 3a, but they could do it.
Yeah, I wouldn't think they'd follow up the 3a launch with Pixel 4 a month or two later. I still think October. Yeah,
but they are kind of going to different markets. I mean, this will, I'm sure, be an expensive phone.
This is a high end. I hope Google's going to do what others are doing now and do a high end and a less expensive version. That would be fantastic.
I mean, but it's. I really like my 3A. I can't say that I see a huge difference between it and the 2XL that I had, but who cares? It's new, and I love new. So it's really nice. But if a 4 comes out,
The other question, and Paul Thurrott brought this up earlier on Windows Weekly, is why doesn't Google tie the release of its high-end flagship phone to the release of the Snapdragon it's going to run on? At this point, it's coming out kind of toward the end of life of the Snapdragon.
Yeah, a lot of the phone makers and even computer makers fall into this trap of chip cycles. And you can tell who's got the most pull with the chip makers because they're the ones who come out early in the cycle.
Right.
You know, they pre-buy or commit to buying, you know, 50 million Snapdragons or Core i5s, whatever the case may be. Or they have their own chips, like Samsung with Exynos. So they're in a very enviable position of having a high market percentage, plus they have their own chips to rely on. So they go in March or April. Everybody else has to follow along.
Right. And to do it in October is to basically say, well,
yeah,
you're not going to have the latest chip, but hey, it's from Google.
But isn't that determined by the holiday shopping schedule?
Maybe.
I mean, if you're going to change something, change the chip schedule then.
So Samsung does the Galaxy S phones in the spring and does a fall release of the Note.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been worked pretty well for them. I don't know. Anyway.
They have lots of products, whereas Google basically
that's
has.
That's true. This is Google's,
If something's wrong with the chip, then you save yourself from.
Well, that's true. But the chip comes out in the spring, comes out around March.
You want some time to expose any problems. I think Carson's right.
Yeah, like a whole year.
Oh, it's really locked down now. Let's take a break. We have Mary Meeker's 333 slide future of the internet.
I brought dinner because I figured we're going to be here till about 9 o'clock.
Yeah, we're not going to go through every slide, but I am counting on you and Kevin to tell me what the important slides are, because I had planned last night I was going to watch the. It's like I went to sleep.
The even ones, the even numbers.
Even. Jeff will do the odd, and we'll. So, Mary Meeker, who is, before we take the break, just to set this up, who is Mary Meeker, Jeff?
She was a famous analyst. Then she was at Kleiner Perkins. And then she left Kleiner Perkins as the basis of a new company. And she's just the Mondo analyst of digital internet and technology. And this, how many years has this been coming out?
God, it feels like we do it every year for a long time.
Oh, we do. She comes out with this 300 plus page PowerPoint once a year. And it's very well done. It's very valuable.
She also became famous because back when she was an analyst, she made some right-on predictions, right? And she got the reputation, which is easy to get and oddly hard to lose, that she's really prescient.
But I don't think she does that as much. I mean, I tend to dismiss the notion of futurists. Right. I can't imagine a more hubristic job title. Right. I see the future.
Right.
And I don't think she does that so much as she just sees the current trends.
Yeah.
And notes them.
She was an analyst at Morgan Stanley, and in 1995, she foresaw how the internet was going to change everything, basically. And they called her the Nostradamus of technology. In fact, she made a lot of money for Morgan Stanley because in 1995, who went public? Oh, yeah, Netscape. Priceline, later Google, they got in on those IPOs. She also recommended Amazon, AOL, Intuit, and Dell. So she made a lot of money for Morgan Stanley with her predictions. It's gotten longer. This article is from 2012 and by Stephen Levy in Wired from 2012, 7 years ago. At that time, it was 99 slides in 20 minutes. This year, 333 slides. And I'd be curious, actually. This is back when she was at Kleiner. I'd be curious to see how much she got right in 2012, but we'll leave that. There's a lot to do just to go through today's slides. So we'll talk about some of Mary Meeker's predictions and what you all think of them in just a second. But first, I got a prediction. More and more people are going to be using virtual private networks. There's two reasons you'd want to use one. One, for your security, especially when you're on an open access point at a coffee shop or you're at a hotel or on a cruise ship or, you know, just anywhere where you're joining in a Wi-Fi network others are on, that means they're on your network too. And so there's some risks involved. If it's Wi-Fi, your data is flying through the air. Plus, because of the nature of networks, people can actually see your computer on there and try to attack it. And there are some really interesting attacks out there on Wi-Fi networks, even of machines that are secure. Just look up the Wi-Fi pineapple and get some idea of what you can do with that thing. So that's one reason you might want to run a VPN. The other one is for privacy. A VPN encrypts all your traffic from your computer to the VPN server so that your internet service provider, your carrier, anybody in that area, anyone in between you and that server can see what you're up to. And can sell that to the highest bidder. We know carriers and ISPs often do that. So that's another reason people use a VPN. There's a third reason, geographic restrictions. ExpressVPN allows you to enter the public internet from many different countries. They have servers all over the world. So you can bypass geographic restrictions on a lot of, let's say you're somewhere and you want to watch Netflix, but you're out of the country, or maybe you're in the U.S. and you want to watch the BBC's iPlayer. There's some really cool reasons you might want to use a VPN. Now, here's what you're looking for in a VPN, something that protects your privacy and security. What, Leo, you say? I thought all VPNs did that. Well, I wish it were true. Unfortunately, some VPNs are not well run. They're not well secured. We've heard problems with VPNs in the past, never ExpressVPN. The other problem, you know, they leak IP addresses. The other problem is, frankly, some VPN people are not scrupulous. And so, especially if you're getting a cheap or free VPN, often they are taking that information and selling it. See, all the stuff that you kept from your ISP now is going through the VPN provider. ExpressVPN does none of that. They secure and anonymize your internet browsing. They encrypt your data. They hide your public IP address. And they never log. They know nothing about you, and they don't want to, so that if ever anybody asks, they could just say, no, I don't know. The other thing I think that's great as pure convenience is they have apps for every platform. It takes one click to turn it on, one click to turn it off. And because they have so many servers, more than anybody else, it's fast. ExpressVPN rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar. I give it my two thumbs up, an absolute recommendation. And it comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. It is literally the best VPN in the world. It's the one you should be using. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get an extra 3 months free when you buy a one-year package at Express. That's the best deal, by the way, at expressvpn.com/twig, the number one most trusted VPN in the world. The one I use, expressvpn.com/twig, 3 months free with a one-year package. We thank them for supporting This Week in Google. And I thank you for supporting us by using that special URL, expressvpn.com/twig. All right, should I pull up the slideshow?
I put my favorite link already there to slide number 22.
Slide number 22. Yes, that was mine too.
Mm-hmm.
I happen to like this one. You're missing
media
the top.
Times, well, for those of you listening, we'll describe all the bars to you.
Yeah. It's cut off a little bit.
It's media time versus advertising spending. 2010 and 2018.
Okay.
So should we start with 2010?
Yes.
Print had very low time spent, 8%, but 27% of ad spend went there.
Oh, interesting.
More than three times what it deserved. Advertisers were still spending in the old world.
Poor old radio, it was the other way around. Lots of time
16%
spent.
16% time spent, 11% ad spent.
Now, TV was
television
equal. 43 and 43,
yeah. Because advertisers understood TV. They knew what it was. They got it. They tracked it markedly.
And nobody ever got fired for buying the Super Bowl.
Right. Desktop, time spent 25%. Advertising spend lagged that, only 19%.
Yeah.
Mobile, 8% time spent, 0.5%
yikes
ad spend, because nobody knew what it was yet. So that was yikes the picture in 2010.
Yeah.
Now let's come to 2018 and start the other end of the chart. Now mobile is almost tied with TV at 33% time spent, 33% ad spend. A third of time spent and a third of ad spend is mobile.
This is actually fairly critical. In fact, just moments ago, the amount of time spent watching screens on mobile bypassed that of TV just this month.
Yep.
So you're really starting to see this big sea change. What's interesting is that advertising spending has gone along with that. That's
they figured it out, right?
Well,
and desktop is also equal 18 and 18.
There's another part of this story to me, which is it's very efficient. When both numbers are the same, and the reason it's so efficient on these digital platforms, I think, is because they know they can measure it better than anything.
Bingo.
Right.
Yep.
So you know what you're getting. I don't know why TV's been so efficient, but maybe...
I think they're just used to it, and they know it. But then if you go to the old media, right, print has gone from 8% to a mere 3%.
Yikes.
Gutenberg is dead. Right? 3% print, ad spend 7%.
More so than if I read still. The Times on the web, that doesn't count? Does that not?
It does not count.
Okay.
This is the medium used, not the kind
God,
of
company. I haven't read anything printed in a long time.
No?
Dead trees. Wow. What a concept.
And radio is still undervalued a little bit. Yeah. 12% of attention goes to it. 8% goes to the spend. So those two are both cockeyed. But this clearly becomes the mobile story going forward. And there's another slide elsewhere in the presentation that shows that in media viewing, like video, it's incremental growth in mobile. It's all new growth. It's phenomenal. That's stealing from TV, and that's how people are watching things now.
Well, that's what's interesting. I think mobile stole not only from TV, but also from desktop.
Yes.
You know, it's really become the platform. And I think that this trend in another 10 years is going to be, you know, 70% mobile. It's going to be huge, right? It's going to double.
Yeah, you're going to watch everything on mobile. You're going to listen to things on mobile. Mm-hmm. You're going to read things on mobile. Who needs these other media?
I'm surprised people aren't sitting at their screens. I guess 34% is not bad.
Yeah, you don't want to have to go and get your news or your whatever media it is. You want it in your pocket.
Right.
That's the whole point, the whole the whole thing here.
And again, it's incremental. It's filling time when you couldn't have been consuming media before.
Right.
So Ronnie Mala at Recode picked out a few other interesting slides. There are now 3.8 billion internet users in the world.
This is really critical. 51%. Now the majority of the world by 1%.
And mostly, most of the new growth, of course, is in mobile. A lot of people with smartphones. Sales of smartphones, though, are declining because everybody's got one.
Mm-hmm. But still huge growth to be had. This is another slide in Asia and Africa.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So as big, I mean, China is gigantic now, killer now, and will only get much bigger.
This is more a victory lap than anything else, but 7 out of the world's 10 world's most valuable companies are tech companies. Microsoft, Amazon, Apple, Alphabet, Facebook, Tencent, those 7. And then, you know, there's Berkshire Hathaway, Visa, and Johnson & Johnson, which is just barely made it. So that's not a surprise, though. But Microsoft, number one, in terms of market cap, I think, and Amazon and then Apple. E-commerce is 15% of retail sales, which this is actually a little surprising. Growth has slowed. But growth in regular retail was only
2%. But growth has slowed. It's still growing.
It's still growing. But you'd think with only 15% of all sales, it would grow, still be at a, you know, on a growth pace.
But you still got to compete with the convenience of going to the quarter store to buy toothpaste.
Bread and milk is keeping the retail sales alive.
And they've already eaten most of the retail sales. So
right.
You can see that their growth would slow because there's not that much more retail to swallow.
Well, but it's only 15% of all sales.
Though. Oh, that's true.
So there's still a lot to go. That's what I was thinking. Internet ad spending has accelerated up 22% last year. Most of the spending still on Google and Facebook. Dang it. But Amazon and
Twitter. Here's the amazing thing
growing.
On this, Leo, for the slide.
Yeah.
Programmatic ad buying. Do I need to explain what that is to the audience?
Yes, what is that?
So programmatic ad, you know those ads that you see when you looked at some boots on Amazon and the friggin' boots follow you around for the next 2 months everywhere you go?
Yes.
That's a combination of retargeting and programmatic advertising. Retargeting has a data point about you that is a cookie that knows, hey, she looked at boots. He looked at boots.
Right.
But programmatic then is an automated, AI-powered, instantaneous trading floor, competitive trading floor, bidding structure for ads. Point being, you open up an ad page. There's a blank ad there. The site says, hey, programmatic networks, I've got somebody who looked at boots. Who wants her? Who wants him? And then all the traders come along and say, well, I'll bid this much. I'll bid this much. I'll bid that much. Wow. And then one ad wins.
Right.
And then goes in there, and that happens in the time it takes you to open the page.
Yeah. Google invented this, and this was really
well.
The
Google
sauce.
And AppNexus invented it.
Oh,
too.
Okay. But Google, the auction model, right, was Google's idea.
Yeah. Yes, the auction model, but this programmatic, there's no notion of the trading floors. So programmatic buying in Meeker's has gone up from 10% in 2012 to 62% last year. Now I was at an event, I held an event at Newark School a few weeks ago. It was a follow-up to a post I wrote about the scorched earth of our media business models. And there was an ad, it was Chatham House, so I can't say who, but there was an ad exec there who scolded the room of media people, these are high-level executives, and said, why are any of you using programmatic? I'm fading as we go here. It commodifies you. You shouldn't be on programmatic. But one of the ad VPs in the room said, sorry, bud, but yeah, you're right. I don't like using it, but that's where all the ad dollars go, and I got to follow where the ad dollars are. So the ad agencies are using programmatic because it's an easy way to get the best price.
Is it more effective, though?
Well, that's an argument that goes on. I can see why
Google loves it and Facebook loves it because it maximizes their price. You know, one of the challenges for old school media like us is to figure out, well, what should we charge for our ads? But they have this automatic system that instantly maximizes it. They literally charge every penny the market will bear.
The old media guys try to say that, oh, targeting's overdone. It doesn't really work. I just saw some, lobbyists in saying that just now because they want to say it's branding that works and it's the environment.
Right.
But if you look at a company like Meredith, which is another Meeker slide, they do a lot of this and they really target very well and their revenue is going up and they bought Time Inc. No, I think the targeting.
They do a lot of it as buying ads, not selling ads. Or do they do programmatic?
Meredith is a publishing company, so they're normally selling ads.
Selling, okay.
But they're doing it around data and they work with companies. This is one of Meeker's examples. And Meeker emphasizes strongly that personalization and targeting has real value. So yes, as far as we know now, it works. The problem is that it's an abundance-based marketplace, so prices will keep falling. And this is why she emphasizes that and desperation will increase. So even so, customer acquisition cost goes down, and that's why things like freemium are going to be better than advertising because it's all but free to the even to the – we were talking before we were on the air, there's a, what's it called? DaVinci, a video platform, a video editing software that's free. And I was saying, how could it be free? And Kevin and Leo schooled me that it has all this high end other stuff. Freemium is essentially a free customer acquisition cost and advertising is going to be expensive. So I think advertising is going to end up suffering. And that means that Google and Facebook could suffer. And meanwhile, Amazon is a force in advertising suddenly now, and it knows more about users. So targeting is still going to be there, but it's going to be in a commodified, abundant marketplace. Sorry, I'm media walking out here.
No, it's interesting. It's of course, I have a little dog in this hunt because that's not how we sell advertising. So should I get out of this business, you think?
Well, in a sense, you kind of do, though. You have a freemium product. I mean, there's a slide on here about Zoom, for example, which she talks about free user conversion to paid subscribers. I mean, as Jeff said, there's no acquisition cost when you're doing it this way with Zoom. And they basically say, we just make our product freaking awesome, and we get conversions as a result of it, that we focus on the product. And
more people are doing that. I love that. Here's the strong platforms. Whew, Google. Growth 1.4 times, Facebook 1.9 times, still smaller than Google, but they're growing faster. And you know who's really growing fast? Amazon, Twitter, Snap, and Pinterest 2.6x. And this is the programmatic buying as a percentage of digital display. In 7 years, it went from 10% to 62%.
Which commodifies everything. Because it doesn't matter where that boot ad appears. What they care about is that person was interested in boots.
The content is irrelevant as long as you get the eyeballs. You got to get eyeballs.
Well, the right eyeballs.
Yeah.
That's the point of targeting. It's
a lead generator, right, Jeff?
Yeah.
Product lead.
Yeah, I mean, that's what all advertising is in the end, right? And that's what this ad executive was saying about programmatic. He said, you're fools to be using it because it was invented really to create more inventory for commerce. It was created so the boot buyer could be found. That was the idea. But then it was so easy for advertisers to go in, and they so loved the idea of getting all this inventory. And the publishers, the reason they went in is, and I heard them say this, and I asked them, they said, well, this is great for us. We get to expose our ad inventory to all these new advertisers. We're not going out and selling. We don't get RFPs for them. So, hey, it's new to us. Well, but the advertiser and the reader don't really give a damn where their ad appears or where they are.
Yeah, but if you're a content creator, it helps you too, because whatever the audience you have, you can monetize, right? Because you may not have boot buyers, but surely if you have people listening, they're buying something.
But in an abundant marketplace, more and more and more places come into these marketplaces, and that boot buyer could be anywhere, and and somebody's going to undercut you.
Right.
But that's why you have to focus on your product, right? I mean, yes, I focus on my content. Leo, you focus on your content and so on. If I make great content and keep people coming back, I don't care that there's an abundance, because hopefully they're coming to me, or, you know, and I get ad revenue.
The I get ad revenue is the tough part.
Yeah, well.
As you get more efficient with programmatic buying, maybe you don't get ad revenue is the point.
That's the problem. That's exactly the problem. Yeah.
That's the last connection. That's a challenge. Reasons for trying a new service is what you were talking about. The best way to do it is free trial or tier. Now this is a survey, so this is little softer number, but free trial or a free tier
for online streaming
is easily the best. Not content library, access to exclusives. That's important. Because I think we all thought it was exclusives that drove traffic to places like Netflix, right? Good user experience. No, free trial. Free ad-supported product. This is Spotify. Spotify, we should probably say, is one of Bond's investments, her company's investments.
All right. Okay.
Our freemium model accounts for about 60% of our gross, says Spotify. Our gross added premium subscribers. I remember during Phil Libin's reign at Evernote, he said, and I think this was a pretty common number, 5% pay, 95% don't.
Right. So you want to hold down the cost of that 95%.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But you know you're going to get a solid 5. I don't know how this relates to that, but it sounds like
the freemium model is
the way people start.
I think the New York Times conversion rate to paid is running a little over 2%. For most newspapers in the U.S., the conversion to paid is running about 0.4%. So a 5% conversion to paid is pretty impressive in that world.
They say an interesting thing here, too, as Spotify does. The ad-supported service subsidizes the costs of the free service, the new subscriber acquisition. So that's actually
low, thus lowering your
very
your
clever
premium side.
Your cost, right. Cost of acquisition. Mm-hmm. Happy customers,
right?
This
so Leo,
is the
stay
Zoom
there for a
thing
second.
You were talking about. Yep,
stay there for 1 second. Like, so if you're a newspaper and you get someone to convert, logic would say you should offer them an ad-free experience. But those who convert are your most frequent users, and so they have a disproportionate amount of your traffic and inventory. So they don't want to take away the ads. So you still give the payers the same kind of crappy experience you give everybody.
That sounds like Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There you go. Big old companies running Hulu. Yep.
Yep. They don't know. They finally added a more expensive ad-free tier. So this is Zoom, free to join when paid user hosts. We really want to get customers to test our product. It's really hard to get customers to try it without a freemium model. Yeah, that's what you were saying. Reasons for trying a new subscription box. Recommended by someone, maybe a podcast.
Which is to say free.
Maybe a podcast. Yeah, it's not free, but it's cheap. Maybe a podcast. now somehow we're actually in the slide deck, and we're only on the 37th slide.
One tenth of the way.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna go through
it's,
stuff like
it's
this.
It's slide crack.
Yeah. She puts more content into one slide than a whole lecture.
This one is interesting. This is interesting. So this is daily digital media usage, and it's desktop, laptop versus mobile plus other.
So right? Mobile is the green bar, the top bar. Desktop, laptop's the middle gray bar. Other
desktop
is
laptop has stayed
blue.
Fairly consistent at a little over 2 hours.
Yeah.
But there's huge growth in the overall, and all of that growth in the overall is mobile.
All of it. Yeah.
But yeah. Shows the network rollout pretty well as well in the USA, because 2008, that's when you started having 3G and 4G, I guess.
See, imagine what 5G. 5G will mean there's no benefit to using a desktop or other connected device, just online.
Well, no. Yeah, you'll be online. Well, even your desktop could even be online, because that'll be your home broadband in some cases.
That's true. Yeah. But it will certainly help mobile considerably, mm-hmm. as will Elon Musk's Starlink, if that ever happens. Daily time spent. This was what I was talking about, the crossing of the lines between mobile and television. Just happened. The red line, the top line, is TV viewing. The blue line is mobile viewing. And for the first time ever, daily time spent in the United States is higher in mobile.
So we can't tell from this slide. So I know we're not going to come up with the answer. I'm just curious how they handle watching online television on a device, because I generally watch YouTube TV on my Pixel Slate, not on a TV. We can, and my wife watches it on a TV, but I don't know where that fits
in. I'm going to make a ruling here that if you're watching on the Slate, that's mobile.
Yeah.
Because you can get up and walk around.
My wife watching YouTube on TV on her TV. It's actually TV.
Yeah.
Okay.
But you're right. I don't know what eMarketer, who created this. It's non-dedupe to find his time spent with each medium individually, regardless of multitasking. I don't know what I mean. I don't know. I don't know. Video time. Daily minutes of watching video actually is pretty constant. Digital's been growing at the expense of TV, but it hasn't overall grown.
I'm surprised it's grown so slow, digital video.
There's only so much TV anybody could watch.
Here you go. It's coming up to slide 50, which is one that
interests
you.
Yeah, that's the one I know.
Okay. Yep. Okay. 70 million monthly active podcast listeners. That's doubled, ladies and gentlemen, over the last 4 years. I wish our audience had doubled.
What year did you start again, Leo?
2005.
Yeah. Do you think this is actually a big growth rate? Because when I saw this, I was like, huh. And Stacy and I were looking at this together, and we were both like, we're not that impressed by that. I mean, it's great to see the growth, but doubling in 4 years by comparison to all the other things that have grown fast, I'm just not blown away by it.
I'm going to have to call an audible, though, on this right-hand column. They're claiming that Apple knows how many podcast downloads there are. Apple does not.
No.
So this number, she's misunderstood. This might be based on Apple's charts, which are based on subscriptions and are heavily weighted for recent subscriptions. That's why we're not on here. We have more downloads, I'm sure, than some of these, but that's not how it works. This is not the most downloaded Apple podcast, but it doesn't matter because these are very big podcasts, that's for sure, but they're not the most downloaded. Because Apple doesn't know that.
I wonder. Yeah, I also wonder if these two data bits are totally separate, don't really relate to each other. They're just two snapshots.
Yeah. Like she threw this in to give you an idea. So, oh, that's a podcast. Right. Oh, I know the Daily.
Right.
Oh, that's a podcast. The Daily is claiming 2 million daily listeners. So that's a big number.
Yeah.
That's a lot of the growth right there. Multiply that times 52 weeks times 5, 110. That's more listeners than the monthly active. Okay, that would make sense. Yeah. Half of the monthly active listeners are listening to the Daily, essentially. Amazon Echo installed base, big growth there. Doubled in a year. So did the Echo Skills. In fact, that is a hockey stick almost of Echo Skills.
Yeah, well, Amazon, if you've been following any of their developer blog, actually Stacy and I look at that on a weekly basis, and they have made it so easy to build skills with their blueprints. I mean, you could be, you know, in grade school and make an Echo skill at this point. I'm not saying it shouldn't count or it should count. That's irrelevant. The point is they have just really made it simple, far simpler. I think.
How does anyone discover a skill? That's
the real question.
That is the hard part. Is the hard part. The discovery mechanism on Amazon's site is not that great. We ought to do more of this on the IoT podcast and highlight some, you know, of our favorites on a regular basis or new ones. It's really, really difficult. How many of those skills are actually used on a daily basis, for example? I'd love to see that number. I would think that percentage is pretty low.
I'll skip through the international growth except to say, you know, she has a whole section on that. It's big. It's growing. It's fast. This is about images.
This is fascinating.
The annual new photos taken, it's going up. It's going up fast. The Instagram monthly active users growing up even faster. Instagram is now at 1 million monthly active users. And the number of photos taken globally is somewhere around a trillion, up from under 7.7 trillion 4 years ago. And she also points this out, that more than half of all tweet impressions contain images of some kind.
Which is amazing. Yeah. Images or other video.
It was just text.
When you get to slide 86, there's a funny quote.
Okay. I can get there by pressing the button fast.
Kevin Systrom.
Creator of Instagram. People have always been visual. Our brains are wired for images. Writing was a hack, a detour. Pictorial languages are how we all started communicating. We're all coming full circle. Mm-hmm. I've heard a variation of this for years. I remember Trey Ratcliffe, the photographer, said, thanks to Instagram and Facebook and Google+, that people are learning to communicate again with images, that images communicate better and more, but not as precisely, I might add.
And I don't think writing was like there would. If we had Instagram, we wouldn't be writing. No.
It's a lot. I mean, have you ever put something together using a IKEA manual, which is all pictorial? It's not fun.
Yeah.
The precision of writing is a lot better for.
Have you guys ever looked at your Twitter analytics or similar service and looked at the engagement of the tweets with images that you send out versus the tweets without images? I've actually done A/B testing using the same text with and without a tweet.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's
images are much better. But we knew this years ago with blogs, right? Yes. A blog post that has an image in it does much better than a blog post that's just text. Yep. But I love Mary's sense of humor because she puts in this slide, which is worth more, a picture or 1,000 words? Here's a picture of little ducklings jumping into the water and 1,000 words about ducklings, which is really, frankly, got a lot more information. So maybe a picture isn't worth 1,000 words, or it just depends on what it's a picture of. I don't know. I think that's pretty funny of Ms. Meeker. Interactive gaming, not growing as fast as I thought. The number of players globally is only up 5% year over year.
It's almost half of the world, though.
Oh, yeah, good point. It's more than 2 billion. Yeah, okay, never mind. 2.4 billion.
It is kind of fair to be a little astonished by this because mobile gaming has really grown
quite
a bit.
That's what it is, yeah.
Fortnite.
Let's see. Epic Fortnite cross-platform evolution versus registered users. Some of these, you know, Ninja got a shout out. Discord registered users. Look at that jump. From almost nothing 2 years ago to somewhat over 250 million
users. Yeah, I wish they could filter out the non-gamers that use Discord. Like my study group at school, we use Discord.
A lot of people use Discord. It's not just gaming, I agree.
Right.
Any more than Twitch, and this is the Twitch slide, is just about gaming. We're on Twitch. She talks about Fortnite and Battle Royale. Freemium business. I guess she's come back to this freemium
In the gaming context. Yeah. Okay.
Right. Just in gaming.
All right. I don't want to go through this whole thing one by one. Give me some other.
185.
Okay.
Hey, halfway through.
Kevin, do you have any before that?
I'm scrolling through real quick, but I don't think I have any before that.
We do this every year. One of these days, I'll figure out a better way to do this. There's so much information in here. But it is, I think it's become a valuable yearly exercise in just kind of the state of the internet, or the state of technology. Here's the perception of the internet.
So you hear, if you listen to media, allow me my moment here. If you listen to media, oh my God, the internet and social media are ruining lives. They're ruining society. It's all a mess. Oh my Lord, sky is falling. This is just awful. However, a Pew survey asked, when you add up internet advantages and disadvantages of the internet, it has been blank for me in society. Mostly good. For me, 88% say it's mostly good.
That's down 2% from 4 years ago, but still
that's
a big number.
Margin of error, folks.
Yeah.
And for society, 70%.
Yeah.
Right? The internet is still a good.
The vast majority of people think good. On balance it's a good. And I think we'd all say that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but not if you listen to,
I whine all the time about social media and stuff, but I think there's just no question that in balance it's good.
You should say that more often, damn it.
I do. I say it a lot. I would not allow to live in a world without the internet.
And if you go to 188, you see a contrast of quotes of where we could be headed, where you see, wrong slide. Never mind. There's another slide later. Never mind.
Okay. Let's skip past that. Internet regulation, open internet, why it's a good thing. Online reviews can boost multi-sided accountability. She gives us an example. Airbnb, 70% of guests leave a review, which I think that's actually very powerful. Yeah. That review system, if it's verified, works quite well. It works well on Airbnb because you can't leave a review unless you stayed there. It doesn't work quite as well on Amazon. Maybe Amazon should require that.
I'd love for somebody to study Uber, where your motivation is to leave sterling reviews even for bad drivers so you don't get a bad review.
Right.
Mm. Two-sided reviews is fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Airbnb is two-sided. I wonder if they put in some measure to keep, like when the landlord does the review, if she's not allowed to see what your review was first or something like that. That would be a good
interesting.
Idea.
Interesting.
Yeah. Social media is important for Pew survey. 69% say getting the government to pay attention to issues. 67% say creating sustained movement for social change. 58% say influencing government policy decisions.
It's a good.
I don't know if anybody would think social media was useful in government in pre-Trump.
Black Lives Matter.
Okay, good. You're right. There you go. And, of course, the Arab Spring. There you go. Okay.
Well, it's not
but it's
good
not the first. It's my, not my go-to way to go contact my congressman, or should it be?
Tweet your
member of Congress?
You bet.
Okay. I guess they're paying attention. Yeah, they're paying attention. Just like brands pay attention to Twitter, even though I think its importance is outsized compared to its actual importance. But well, this is food for
That's
thought.
Most of what I have. Yeah. Kevin, did you have anything else?
No, I mean, we were kind of interested in what's going on in China in general. But I mean, as you said earlier, Jeff, tons of growth opportunity. Just about everything that Mary talks about there will be dwarfed here in the U.S. by what happens in Asia between internet speeds, usage, so on and so forth. So
one example I remember, I couldn't remember the names of these services. There were group buying services many years ago, 10, 12 years ago.
Yeah, they're still around.
But nobody really used them. You know,
it's like Mass China, Drop, I think it's called.
That's kind of stuff. China, one of them, you know, huge, gigantic.
Yeah.
Things that we didn't scale, they're now scaling.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot here about work and on-demand work. A lot about health.
This is a disappointing slide to me. The number of sites supporting two-factor authentication has actually gone down over the last 4 years. That's really disappointing to me. I would have hoped that would have been a completely different direction. That's just odd.
I have a horror story to share, but it's my thing, so I will wait till the very end, and it relates exactly to this.
Oh, Okay. Ooh. Okay. Cyber warfare.
That was good thing conversation there,
yes.
Kevin.
Yes, I have a good thing too, so stay tuned. All right. Ooh. So thank you, Mary
Thank
Meeker.
You, Mary Meeker.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the better presentations this year. Lots of.
I really think it was very good. Yeah, yeah. I was glued to. Oh, I didn't watch her, but I went through the PowerPoint.
Yeah.
She's working on the next one already.
Good Lord. Yeah, she only has 333 days to create those slides.
Yep. One slide a day. Get going, girl.
Our show today brought to you by WordPress. See, if I were creating a great presentation or a great talk, I would want to put that on my personal website as just another data point. So then when people Google my name, they go to my website. That's the first thing that shows up. That's the place, your home on the internet, where you show your best work. Whether you're an individual or a business, is your website. Everybody needs a website. Everybody. That's my campaign. Everybody needs a website, and WordPress is the place. It's the best place to make your website, WordPress.com. They do the hosting. They have powerful site-building tools, thousands of themes. And if you ever run into a problem or a question, they have full-time support 24/7 from actual WordPress experts, 300 strong, and they're just great. They're just great. WordPress.com lets anyone pursue whatever it is they love by launching a site that's free to start and has room to grow. That really, since the day Matt Mullenweg started WordPress, that was always the plan. WordPress was created so anyone can publish their ideas. There are no gatekeepers. You own your content forever. And it's fine to be on Facebook and Twitter and Medium and everywhere else, but if you don't have your own site, you're missing out. And if you're a business without a website, what the heck? WordPress.com. I sometimes see business sites like in other places, and it's like, come on, you know, this just, it could look so much better, so much more professional. That's why I use it, LeoLaporte.com. I've been there for 12 years. WordPress has no two-week trials, no hidden fees. You own your content forever, free to start, but it is built to grow with you to get you wherever you want to be tomorrow. And it's so flexible and powerful. Some of the biggest companies on the earth use WordPress.com to build their websites. Not only, we talked to Harry McCracken. He said, yeah, Fast Company, it's our content management system. Fortune.com, Quartz. Millions of people, big and small, use WordPress.com every day to turn their dreams into reality. When it's time to create a new website or your first website or a gift for somebody just coming into the world, this is the new coming out party. Create a website and gift it to them. WordPress.com/twig. You'll get 15% off any new plan purchase. WordPress.com/twig. We thank WordPress so much for supporting This Week in Google. They're a great, great partner. And we thank you for supporting us by using that URL. WordPress.com/twig. Google has bought 270 companies in the last decade, or actually in the 2000s, compared to a much smaller number of acquisitions by Facebook. Is there anything to say about that? I just like the production is beautiful of this. This is from the Privacy Project, Tim Wu. Big tech companies like Google and Facebook are in the reality products of hundreds of mergers. And they have this great graph showing how Google became Google or Alphabet by acquiring 270 companies over two decades.
But the problem is they present this under the aegis of privacy. And a lot of these acquisitions are back-end technology.
Double-click.
Presentation technology, advertising technology. They don't. Most of these do not bring users and user data with them.
I did see, and let me see if I can go back and find that article, because I did bookmark it, a good analysis of why current antitrust law can be effectively used against or in these big technology companies. And let me see if I can find it. I hope I bookmarked it, because I want to give you the exact quote. I think I didn't, but it was, I believe, a member of Congress. But the point was, here's the criterion: was that acquisition done because it's a sensible growth to the business, or to stop a competitor or put a competitor out of business or to keep that competitor from becoming a problem. And he says, if we use that acid test, that's a good way to judge whether the, you know, these acquisitions are sensible or not.
Where do you stand on T-Mobile Sprint?
Well, that's a big one going on right now. And now, yep. Just how many state attorneys general,
10,
I think, are suing, trying to stop it, making the, I guess, reasonable claim that with only three big phone companies, and it would be roughly a third, AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, Sprint, there's not enough competition. I don't know. That's a lot. Three companies is not a monopoly.
It's more cable companies than I have.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you could also make the case that Sprint and T-Mobile are weak, third
That's
and fourth
the other problem.
By themselves. Mm-hmm. And that allows Verizon and AT&T really to stomp all over them. And if you want 5G to take off, you're going to need somebody strong enough to do the very hard thing that's 5G, which is putting in double the number of towers.
All right, you just convinced me.
I think I'm a little biased because I'm a T-Mobile customer, and I would love to see a better, stronger T-Mobile. I think T-Mobile's done a lot of good. I hate things. Some of the things T-Mobile does, for instance, zero rating is a very, very bad thing. It's against net neutrality, and they zero rate a lot of services. But they also got everybody else to lower their costs, to provide decent international plans. I think they're scrappy.
I'm behind on this question because I remember the old days of the radically incompatible standards they use. Are all the phone companies now...
Yeah, LTE.
Relatively interchangeable.
There still is that CDMA, GSM Gulf, but any modern phone uses LTE, and that's what they all support. And 5G will be the same way. It will be across all platforms. So the world is moving we're past that. We're moving away.
And it was mostly a U.S. thing, Jeff. I mean, most companies around the globe were not. There was only one other major CDMA. I can't remember.
I think Japan was CDMA.
Was it Japan? Yeah. So...
So these NTSC. Lawsuits are essentially, you know, the FCC chairman came out in favor. The Department of Justice said, well, we don't think so. And these Democratic attorneys general filed suit, all 10 of them, because if the merger goes through, the prices consumer pay for phone plans would rise because there'd be one fewer competitor. I don't think that's true. Sprint is so weak. I don't think anything Sprint does is like what... How does that impact what AT&T's pricing is? That just doesn't make sense. I think you have if you have three strong competitors, that's better than two strong competitors and two weak competitors.
Right.
So I don't think I agree. The lawsuit may not stop the merger, but the Times says it could delay the deal significantly. They wanted to close it by next month. That ain't going to happen.
Mm-mm.
Federal regulators might fast track it, but the courts have it, and that, you know, how long that's going to take. The attorneys general say that the merger would cost T-Mobile and Sprint subscribers $4.5 billion. Low-income and minority communities would be hit especially hard. It's exactly the sort of consumer harming, job killing mega merger our antitrust laws are designed to prevent. I don't know.
These days, everything costs $4.5 billion.
Yeah, everything, literally. Everything. It's just the new normal. I kind of am in favor of it. But, I understand that the competition is critical, but I don't think this is a bad thing, especially when you have companies that aren't doing very well. Remember, how many satellite radio companies are there in America? There used to be two. They were both about to go, Sirius and XM were both about to go out of business. So they were allowed to merge.
It's even better than that. They were one company. The government insisted they be split up into two, which means that neither had the full, and to this day, don't have the full range of frequency that they could have had if they had stayed one.
The good news there is that the competition to satellite radio is terrestrial radio, and there's plenty of competition there, and your iPhone. But... I don't know. I think we should. I think I'm in favor of the merger.
I have the same bias as you as a happy T-Mobile customer. So
I'd love to see it be stronger, and I want it to be strong in 5G.
I, as a Verizon customer, I'm for it because I've seen.
You should thank. Should thank T-Mobile.
Yeah, I've seen exactly. I've seen. I got back an unlimited plan because of T-Mobile.
That's right.
And I haven't seen Sprint affect anything on Verizon or AT&T.
Oh man, this absolutely brought tears to my eyes. This is a story in the New York Times. You know, the Times makes me crazy because they do that. They do things like publish that press release journalism, the crappiest journalism ever, and then they do this. This was in Sunday's New York Times Magazine, an incredible expose. Do you remember in 2008 when the Universal Studios back lot burned?
Barely.
Yeah. It was a big deal. It was the town square and Back to the Future and a lot of Western sets. It might have made a more of an impression if you knew that also burned there was a warehouse rented by Universal Music Group that contained the master recordings, 22,000 square feet, of more than 500,000 recordings. Mm-hmm. And this, I know as a music lover, Kevin, this has got to affect you. Every single Buddy Holly master is gone. Yep. At the time, Universal downplayed it. Oh, we got copies of everything. The masters, those are second copies. It's not true. And the only reason that this story is coming out now is because the man in charge of the warehouse was fired by UMG last year and is now talking. And it is devastating. There's also a lot of the documents came from a lawsuit UMG filed against Universal Studios. And in discovery, there was a lot of information about what we really lost. And part of the reason UMG didn't want to tell people is because the artists themselves would have been livid. Because Steely Dan, for instance, and there's an anecdote in here about Steely Dan's manager calling saying, we want our masters. Where are the masters? And it turned out that some of the masters had been stored somewhere else. So they gave them those, but they didn't mention that a whole bunch more of those albums are gone. Now, I think to understand the importance of this, because a lot of people say, well, I can get everybody's Holly song on Spotify or Apple Music right now. What's the big deal? But these are the originals. These are the actual recordings. And Kevin, maybe you can speak to this, but I know when the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper was just remastered.
Right.
And Giles Martin went back to the vault, got the tapes, the 8-track tapes with handwritten notes.
That's the key. Yep.
And they redigitized them with more modern equipment. And the point made in this article is there's stuff on the masters that you couldn't hear on the masters until more modern technologies came along, allowing us to capture that. Plus, as you know from Sgt. Pepper, there's outtakes that were never released that are on the masters.
Yep.
Yep.
I don't know. This could make you cry. It was the biggest disaster in the history of the music business. The things that were lost, Frank Sinatra original recordings, Etta James original recordings. UMG put out a press release where they mentioned two artists nobody had ever heard of and said, oh, you know, it was people like this. It was people like this and John Coltrane and Patsy Cline. Almost all of Coltrane's masters from Impulse were lost. Just devastating. And they're gone. So there's not much more to say about it. But it's shameful that UMG was able to hide this for so long.
And, I mean, two contrary thoughts here. One is that in a digital world,
it would never have happened. Yeah.
Though it says we have to worry about formats and wise storage strategies and other things, that it could happen in the sense that formats become useless.
I should also point out there were digital masters lost as well as tape masters in storage in this warehouse. So digital can burn down just as much as, and of course, a vault, things can happen. The originals, there's only one. There only ever is one, no matter how many copies you make. It just makes me very sad to
this. A lot of people are probably sitting here because I hear this one, like every time there's a new remastered album from the Beatles or something.
Why do you buy that?
Exactly.
Don't you already have that?
you do have that. You don't have exactly that, if it makes sense, because they can. You mentioned the handwritten notes when Giles Martin went through the masters, and they spent so much time reading the notes and trying to remaster the original Sgt. Pepper's the way the Beatles intended it to be, the way they wanted it to be heard, not the way some other person wanted it to be heard. And if you need a simple comparison, if you're familiar with the Let It Be album, the Phil Spector Wall of Sound, there's also the Let It Be Naked album, right, which is without the Wall of Sound. Vastly different music, even though it is the same music. And that's maybe not the greatest comparison, but it's a simple one to, if you've ever heard the two of them, that you can understand. It's really, really sad to see this original. And that's what it is. It's original music. We have copies of everything these right. days. So you can say, I've got it on my iPhone, but you really don't.
Well, and there are stuff you don't have copies of. There's outtakes. Right. There's extra material. Yeah. There's hundreds, millions of hours lost. The other thing is, Martin remixed the mono mix. So that's really interesting because he had the masters, he had the original tracks. And could mix those in stereo from a mono master.
Yeah, that was the big thing with the Beach Boys reissue that came out probably 10 years ago now.
A Smiley Smile. What was it?
Well, it had Smile. The two big things were it had extra tracks from Smile.
Right,
which were never released, and was a huge, huge thing for
I remember
Beach
that.
Boys fans.
That was so awesome.
And also, Brian Wilson was mostly deaf in one ear, so he did everything in mono.
Right.
So they re-released stuff in stereo
What the market demanded.
Yeah, exactly. No, they re-released stuff.
Oh, I see. They were able to.
They were able to
it way with the Beatles. They kind of said, we got to make a stereo version for the Americas because they won't buy mono. Mm-hmm. So they just kind of threw out a stereo mix. It was terrible.
Oh, yeah.
Notoriously terrible.
People on different tracks.
Right. It was horrible.
Paul's in one ear. John's,
right. Nobody cared. It was an afterthought. Anyway, so that's the story. I mean, there's nothing to say except that this is just one more example of why the music industry sucks and that these record labels were just, they didn't care, really. They really didn't care. And, it's sad. Read the articles. Really well done. The information from the litigation is pretty funny. Because they talk about a New Jersey warehouse that UMG also owned, that the upstairs tenant, a food service company, loaded too many pallets of salad dressing into its storage hold,
Jesus.
Which caved in the ceiling above the vault, ruptured a pipe, collapsed sheetrock, dangling electricity lines, hundreds of shattered salad dressing bottles, and a foot of water in a vault that contained 350,000 master tapes, including the entire Motown catalog. Mm. They actually were able to save a lot of those, but thank God, but they didn't save anything from the Universal fire. Mamas and the Papas, Joni Mitchell, ton of stuff. Tom Petty. I just thought I'd bring that up. There is a tech angle in the sense that we have digitized this stuff, but the problem is there's always better technology. These tapes, especially, contain a lot more information than you can create in a recording, in a performance. So, even stuff as recent as Sheryl Crow, stuff was lost. So there you have that. Let's do some Google changing of the logging, shall we? Play the trumpets.
The Google change log.
Here's a huge one. The Google Assistant is now available in Waze.
Yay!
What took them so gosh darn long? It feels like they bought, this is an example of where Google probably bought a company to keep them from becoming too big, right?
No.
They wanted the technology.
I disagree.
They've really not used it well.
They don't, but here's what they did. At I.O. a couple of years ago, I talked to Waze people, and I tried to talk to Waze people when I was working with a newspaper company to work with them. And no, I think they were left alone so that they would develop new stuff.
Oh.
Waze as a product is magnificent. It's not a case where, you know, everything that AOL bought and others like that, and CompuServe bought and Yahoo bought and all those companies in the past, they ruined everything. Waze is far from ruined.
It's just not improved much.
Than Google Maps.
It is? Okay.
I think it's better because they left them alone in Israel to develop.
Good.
I'm not defending Google in this case. I'm just saying that Waze is brilliant.
Yeah.
And you got to look at how.
Well, and the nice thing now in Android Auto, and you can use Waze or Google Maps, which is really nice. And I think anybody who commutes knows that Waze is the superior experience from that point of view.
Yes.
Yeah.
You can say things like, hey, gee, I want to report traffic or find me a route without tolls or... and so on. What I wonder is whether it'll do things like find me the nearest Starbucks or.
I hope so. See, that's an interesting take on it because I was hoping they would incorporate all of those great Waze features into Maps.
Right. Same.
It's an interesting point of view. They wanted to preserve it.
Yeah. And it's weird too because one gets so used to something. My son Jake uses Maps. I use Waze. And I don't know all the tricks because you've got to know the tricks well. Because you're not going to be screwing around with UI when you're driving. So I use Waze religiously, and I just don't know from Maps unless I'm walking.
Is there a real problem with taxis in India? Because Google has introduced a new alert for you when your taxi goes off route. Like he's taking you somewhere else, but it's initially rolled out in India. Maybe that's just where they're testing it. But your phone will alert you if your ride goes off route by 500 meters or more. Like, are they
being overcharged?
Maybe it's for overcharging. I don't know. I was thinking kidnapping. Okay, you're right. It's more like he's taking the long way. It's the long way alert. Okay, so it is available in India. Maybe it'll be offered in other places. But I really do see it. This is what I think. Google's doing a lot of good things in Maps. And Waze felt like it was a little bit behind, but okay.
I don't know if you're ever in cabs or Ubers, but do you find yourself sometimes going ahead and turning on Waze just to track and make sure that they're taking the right route or how long it's going to take you or that kind of stuff?
Usually I just, well, cabs, I never worry. Well, maybe I do. I should worry. I guess Uber, you know they're not going off route, right? Because they have the, I don't know. I just sit back, relax.
You're not paying more for the Uber if they go off route.
I just figure, my feeling is they drive this every day. They know the best way to go.
Yeah.
Especially from the airport. You'll get in a cab from JFK to Manhattan. I know you probably have this happen all the time, Jeff, because you probably make that trip monthly, daily, weekly. But they'll... You know, they're on the highway and they go, oh, crap. And then just go off on the side roads up there by the houses. And I feel so bad for the people who live there because all these cabs are going. It's all cabs.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to say no. First of all, I'm just not going to say no, period, any cabbie.
They're probably using Waze. That's the.
Yeah, it looks like a Waze detour. Definitely. What did I have here? Oh, I am sad to say, did you ever use Google Trips? I like this idea. I thought, it's not very old. They were going to use it kind of as a TripIt substitute, but now it's dead. It will be incorporated, they say, into Google's new travel search page. But after August 5th, if you're using Google's Trips, which I did because I really liked it, no more. It would grab flight ticket and hotel booking information from your Google inbox, set up a trip in the app, make other suggestions saying, I know you're going to Rome. Here's some restaurants you might like. I thought it was very useful. Google apparently has a new page that's going to replace
this. Reminding me how much I miss inbox.
Yeah, they just killed
stuff. I was just going to say that, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was not just that, but they also, the trip part of inbox was brilliant.
Oh,
brought all the stuff together in one discussion. It would add more value. It was great. And Gmail is just so friggin' ugly.
Sometimes changelog is things going away, not just new things. And in fact, according to some guy named Kevin Toefel, the Pixel Slate Celeron edition is going away too.
Yes, it is. I hear that's a WordPress blog, by the way.
is it? It's very attractive. It's very attractive. And you don't apparently like me using an ad blocker. That must be a WordPress plugin. I'm going to turn off my ad blocker because
That was the GDPR bit.
I clicked there, the GDPR, but at the bottom there was an ad.
I have my little personal note there. But yes, ads aside, the Pixel Slate Celeron, which probably should have never been launched.
You couldn't even buy it, right?
It wasn't long. It was not long. I think it was on the market until about a week after the bad reviews of that particular model came out. And it's a darn shame because of the Celeron going away. That probably should, as I said. It just doesn't have the horsepower to handle that type of device, 3,000 by 2,000 pixels and so on. But that gave all of the Pixel Slate line a bad name. And it's a much improved device now. So it's a real darn shame that happened. It probably never should have. You can't get one anymore anyway. So
they probably did it so that they'd have a $599 starting price, but they've actually taken care of it anyway by reducing the price of the other models, right?
Yes. I don't know if that's temporary, but yes, the prices have come down on all the other models. I agree with you because when they talked about the Slate, they said it's coming. It'll start at $599. Yeah. So that's probably why
all these companies do that. Because they know. I was going to say they think we're stupid, but it's not. They know that the headline will say $599.
It's not rocket science. People under promise and over deliver. Right.
Everybody done it.
You have one more there, Leo, that I wanted to mention.
Google Photos.
This is bad.
Will no longer sync.
You think
it's
bad?
I do. I think a lot of people really rely on this.
It won't automatically. The problem was, so I accidentally said yes to that, and my drive is now filled with photos that are in Photos anyway. Right? I didn't want that.
G Suite users can choose to sync photos to Drive. Why would you do that? It's a second copy, and it's eating up your storage.
Not necessarily. The photos are technically stored on Drive. This is really, or at least they used to be.
But you have unlimited storage for Google Photos.
Yeah, I think the bigger issue is having to use two apps. Some people just want to go into Drive and get Drive stuff. What's different about Photos that they have to be on their own UI and all that, right?
It really should
be optional. And it was confusing. I'll give them that.
This was for G Suite. G Suite users do not have the option to show photos from My Drive in Google Photos. But you can choose to sync photos to Drive so that when you upload a file of photos, it's automatically uploaded to the folder in Google Photos folder in Drive. Once these changes go into effect, this folder will no longer get updates.
But I don't think this is just for G Suite, because there's a link that, like in that story from the Google blog, the G Suite updates, there's a helpful link that takes you to the keyword, which is their main blog.
Right.
And they're not really saying G Suite only here.
Well, I love it. We heard feedback that users were confused. I am now.
It is confusing. And I get exactly what Jeff is saying because, you know, on Drive, if you have the information pane on and it shows your most recently updated files, all of a sudden you've uploaded some photos from your phone automatically.
There's
tons of images in there. You're like, what is that? Yeah.
Starting in July, new photos and videos from Drive will not automatically show in Photos. Similarly, new photos and videos in Photos will be not added to the Photos folder in Drive. Photos and videos you delete in Drive will not be removed from Photos. Items you delete in Photos will not be removed from Drive. But I'm still puzzled why.
Confusing.
Is that the only reason people would put their photos in Drive, is so that they have that available when they make presentations or stuff? Why didn't it just say, here's your photos and do you want to see your photos in Photos?
Maybe it should link to just photos.google.com and be done with it.
Or give you another place you can get them.
And here's the, so this is under the G Suite updates. Is this only for G Suite customers?
No.
No.
It's also under the normal updates.
Okay, thanks.
If you look in their normal
everybody
updates
next month.
It's, yeah.
But it would only affect people who are intentionally copying photos to drive.
Those who enable the Google Photos.
On. Yeah.
Yes.
It's not on by default, right?
No.
No. And it does make sense to simplify it.
Yeah, their explanation was very simple.
Yep. And confusing.
Yes. We ain't doing it no more.
Google's celebrating for the second year in a row, 100% running on renewable energy. Now, that's a little deceptive because, of course, they're not. But they're buying credits, I guess, right? Yeah. So what it really is that during 2018, their purchases of energy from sources like solar and wind once again matched our entire electricity consumption. So in Mountain View, I presume they get their electricity from this Mountain View Electric Company, PG&E, which is generated by a variety of means, including diesel, wind, water, coal. I don't know if we have any coal plants in the California, but
hamsters,
you know, hamsters, whatever it can. But what they do is they buy offsets so that they buy as I don't even.
Excuse me. It's confusing because electricity is electricity, no matter how it's produced.
Right.
Like I pay for wind generated here in Pennsylvania. I pay a few extra cents per kilowatt hour. I'm getting the same electricity as my next door neighbor who doesn't get wind power. Right. I mean, it's a shell game of sorts.
They should do it. It's good.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's better that way. See, I have solar panels on my roof, mm-hmm. so I know that the electricity comes from there into my house. Actually, it doesn't because it then goes from there into my house and up to the PG&E. Snarfs it up and then gives me money. And that's the Google change law. Ah, such sad news. We talked about this on Sunday. Maker Faire is closing its doors, as is Make Magazine.
Though,
there's some good news. Everybody's favorite VR maven, Palmer Luckey, says I'd buy it. Did he?
Not yet.
He's kind of, you know, he might be a big talker. I don't know. This is nuts, he tweets to Dale Dougherty. Some friends and I would love to help save Maker Media. I love Maker Faire, and I've been a Make reader since literally the first issue. Okay. Good. I hope so.
Well, that was 5 days ago, and I haven't heard that he's bought
hope
it
so.
Yet.
So. All 20 staffers were laid off. I'm sad to say. I am a huge fan. And what's really sad is they were doing well. They made their ticket goals for the most recent Maker Faire. The magazine was beloved for 15 years.
15 years? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it really created a maker movement, I think. But it's been tough. Dougherty, who we've had on our shows, he's a great guy. They're just up the road a piece. Is going to try to get some way to keep the Make Online Archive running and allowing third parties to license the name to throw affiliated events. So they're not going for bankruptcy, rather assignment for benefit of creditors process.
Does it say how much debt he's in?
The company had raised $10 million. The magazine had 125,000 paid subscribers, 1 million YouTube subscribers, 1.45 million people attended its events in 2016. I think what was really bad is that it never was able to make money without sponsorships, and they had some big sponsorship pullouts. Microsoft and Autodesk pulled out before this year's flagship Maker Faire, and I bet you that was it. They just, you know, sometimes...
One bump in the road, and
you don't have a lot of
tires
resilience.
Gone.
Yeah. But geez, I thought that was such a great thing, and I have a lot of Maker books and magazines. We've interviewed many of them.
You actually make stuff,
make people. I don't make anything.
You used to.
I sit in my underwear and watch TV. This is
on the phone.
On the phone, on my little phone.
According to Mary Maker.
We are actually, but of course, we're older, right? So the older demographic, we're going to be doing the old-fashioned thing. I have more TVs in the house than I have phones, and I have a lot of phones. I don't know what any of that just meant.
there you go. Jeff's got a trio of phones in his hand.
Yeah, see? I have a TV. Actually, it's kind of embarrassing. I don't have TVs in the bathrooms yet.
We have one.
I have TVs pretty much everywhere else. Good. Well, you're a former TV guide critic, so it's okay. It's okay for you. There's too much good TV. I can't keep up. So I have to watch more. Fortnite maker Epic Games acquires House Party this morning. We don't know for how much. House Party has kind of an interesting story. Do you remember Meerkat?
Yeah.
Remember?
Sure.
And Jeff Needles, who used to work for us, was so into Meerkat. We all kind of got into it, allowed you to stream live video. And then the company that started Meerkat shut it down, saying, yeah, it's failing. Because it was one of those things that had a big uptake, and then nobody used it after a while. And I think that they went on to do House Party. That was their pivot. They took some of the same technology and created House Party. In fact, here's the article from 2016 from The Verge. Meerkat built a new app in secret, and almost 1 million people are using it. It's House Party. It's basically Meerkat for groups, kind of like group hangouts. But it's done all right. And as of 2016, they had 1 million users. Jeff Needles, by the way, continued to work for House Party and was very happy this morning.
Really?
Yes. Well, yeah, he made the right choice. He left us to go to work for them. Epic does Fortnite. And I think what's really interesting about this is many people think that Fortnite is actually a social network more than a game, including me. That for the 12-year-olds who play it, and every 12-year-old plays it, it's the lobbies and the socializing that occur in Fortnite are really a big part of the game. So House Party kind of makes sense. It is a video chat that they could perhaps build into Fortnite. CEO Tim Sweeney says, by teaming up, we can build even more fun shared experiences than what could be achieved alone. House Party says, nothing's going to change. The app will stay the same. But I suspect what you'll see is House Party integrated into Fortnite. And this is how you disrupt companies like Facebook. You don't try to make another Facebook.
Right.
I would say this is a company to watch. Did you read the article from Kev.net? Why you probably don't need reCAPTCHA.
I tried, but good Lord, it goes on forever. So I was hoping you would just explain it to me.
I will explain it to you. His basic position is you probably don't need it if you run a website. People use reCAPTCHA to prevent robotic logins, automated logins by spammers and things like that. It's a Google service that's free, so a lot of people use it. But Google gets a lot of information from it. And as it resonated with me because I'm pissed off at the new traffic sign, is this a car CAPTCHA? Remember, you've seen the grid.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
It's such a pain. It's horrible. And it's training Google's automated vehicles for free.
It's ML. Yeah, it's machine learning. We're doing
and
the work.
I'm doing all the work for Google for free. And so his point is that you're giving Google a lot of privacy information, plus you're giving them machine learning for free.
What privacy information are you giving them just because Google
Well,
has
they know
a
you're there. They
the
see you. Yeah. It's a Google pic. I use Brave and turn off all those pixels. So there was a debate I read on Hacker News about this article about whether you really need to use reCAPTCHA or not. His position is it doesn't. There's lots of other ways to prevent robotic sign-ins. Many developers vastly overestimate the likelihood of customized spam, he says. He also offers some reCAPTCHA alternatives that are well known, and of course it's a back and forth battle between spammers. But I kind of agree. I feel I mean, the old CAPTCHA was such a pain in the butt anyway Now they've added all these images. It's even more painful.
Well, so I'm going to some very, very small conference with 20 people, and they have me sign, you know, register and put all my stuff in the spine. Nobody ever goes to this page, ever, for any reason, and they have a recapture on it.
Yeah. It's just kind of automatic.
What robot is going to sign up for the conference?
Yeah, and there are other ways to do that, and other captures. So I kind of agree. If you're Twitter or Facebook, no capture will solve all your issues. For everyone else, he writes, there are still a lot of simple tools and heuristics that go a long way in helping to stop abuse. Be kind to your users, and try your best not to force them to spend their free time completing recaptures for Google. They will appreciate it, Kevin Davis. I agree. I will appreciate it. Drives me nuts. Have I Been Pwned is for sale. Troy Hunt, who was the security researcher who created one of the single most useful services out there. If you haven't used Have I Been Pwned, give it a shot. It allows you to enter your email address. Actually, let me go to it just to show you real quickly. It allows you to enter your email address. And you'll see if you are in one of the massive breaches that corporations have reported. And by the way, my email address has been pwned on 28 breach sites and found in two pastes. So there's also, though, I think an even more useful tool where you can enter a password and see if that password is among the 500 million real world passwords exposed in data breaches. And by... So I entered monkey123, and apparently so did 60,803 other people, and they use it for real passwords. Use your good, real, secure password, maybe your LastPass, MasterPassword, something like that, just to make sure. People sometimes ask me, well, wait a minute, I shouldn't put my real password in there, right, because he gets it. No, the way the JavaScript works, and it's unobfuscated, he does not get it. It's actually a very clever hashing technique that he uses to make sure to check. He checks against a hash database to see if your hash shows up. So it's safe to do that. And he has a whole explanation of how that works and so forth. But this is a really good site. And Troy, it's such a good site. A lot of people use it. And Troy says, I just can't. I want to sell it. He created it back in 2013 for free as a kind of a labor of love. So I just mentioned this because somebody should buy it. It's a great thing.
Well, but it matters who buys it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Somebody good should buy it.
I mean, he's not going to sell anybody bad.
No, I don't think so. Troy's pretty serious.
But you don't know whoever sells it can sell it again. And
yeah. Actually, I don't know. Yeah, that's interesting.
I mean, it's a hell of a database of passwords. Then again,
he has a series of seven commitments that he sets forth saying why this is going to be okay, and so forth. So he's going to work with KPMG to find an organization that would fit his requirements, and it really is important. Have I Been Pwned? So
I would hate to see it go away.
Yeah, you've used it.
Oh yeah! In fact, I get emails every once in a while, like, "Hey, your email address showed up in another breach."
And it's built into 1Password, I think. I think I've seen it in Chrome, maybe. I can't remember where else I've seen it, but it's great. It'll let you know. It's nice to know. Chrome has a plugin that will let you know if your password has been used elsewhere. I think Password Checkup. I don't know if they use Have I Been Pwned, but that's another great Chrome plugin. Okay. Okay. Anything else? Did I leave anything out, kids?
Oh, we got so much stuff here.
I know.
So
it's a giant day.
I'd like to talk about Stadia just for a tiny bit.
Okay. So they did. Yeah. We should mention it. They rolled out
because I figured out who it's for.
More information. They figured out who it's for?
I did.
It's for me.
It's not for me. Yeah. It's for you. So Stadia, the announcement was on Monday. It will launch in November in the U.S., U.K., Canada, and 14 other territories. 31 games, 21 publishers. They have an initial Founders Edition for a bizarrely overpriced $130.
Bought it.
You get a Chromecast Ultra. That's $89 by itself. I already have one. You get this weirdo Wi-Fi controller, although that's a good thing. You don't have to use it for Stadia. You get 3 months Stadia, which will be $10 a month after that. And you also get a game that you don't want called Destiny 2.
That about sums it up.
Yeah. The weird thing about Stadia, so it's one of those, it's like OnLive, it's like Gaikai. It's a streaming service, runs on Google's servers, very powerful servers, has some very nice features. They showed it, they had an event at GDC and they talked about that. You can run it on anything, doesn't need a lot of power. In fact, a Chromecast Ultra, so you plug that into your TV. The Chromecast Ultra isn't doing anything except streaming the game. Your controller, which is Wi-Fi, is talking directly to the server. So there's low latency, supposedly, although really the proof will be in the pudding, depending on your internet service provider. The weird thing is it's not a streaming service in the sense a lot of them are, where you get access to a bunch of games. You have to outright buy the game to play it.
Right. So this is a little different than the Microsoft version, which is what, Game Pass?
Yeah, you pay a fee, a monthly fee, you get access to 100 games.
100 games, right. I was just looking at it today because I have an Xbox collecting dust
now. I'm a member. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. So, yes, this is different in that, you're getting Destiny 2 and all the content for it. Google has not said what other content you will get for free as part of this premium service.
Baldur's Gate 3 will ship. Pretty exciting.
I like Baldur's Gate, but all right.
It's a fun enough game. Right. I mean, okay.
Yeah.
So Farming Simulator 19.
I can pass on that one. The thing is, a lot of people are getting worked up appropriately for the $10 a month, and I still have to buy my games effectively.
Yes.
But the pro service is literally the first part that's launching in November. And that will give you 4K 60 frame per second service for your games.
Internet service provider allowing.
Well, that's a whole other issue. The whole caps. But that's not Google's issue. That's individual's issue.
Yeah,
but,
well, it's my issue if I buy it because I still have to get through my internet service provider.
You'll be able to play first 65 hours.
Well, there you go.
That's good.
There you go. Yeah, that's a lot of Baldur's Gate.
Yep.
In 2020, the subscription part of it will be free if you want to drop down to 1080p, 60 frames per second.
Which is probably streaming. Better, frankly, for streaming.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to go through your caps much slower, number one. And if you don't have a 4K TV, what's the point? And so on and so forth. You can drop out of the service. It's a month-to-month thing, so you can switch back and forth. You don't lose your content if you drop from one service to the other or leave for 3 months.
I feel like given the competition from Sony and Xbox, mm-hmm. this is a non-starter. I don't even understand. I think Google's going to give up on this in 3 months.
Let me explain to you.
Okay, we know the market now. Okay. Karsten Bondi, once again.
Just to go back a little bit, my son, Zach, is 14, and he has been ridiculing this since they first announced
it. He has. He made a video.
He thinks it's the dumbest idea ever.
It's not for him.
Until there was another announcement at E3, Ubisoft announced that they are going to be streaming their entire PC catalog to for $14 a month, you can get their entire, it's either streaming or download on Steam and Stadia.
That does change things a little bit.
We are a gaming household, but clearly, we don't have a gaming PC.
What? But, you know, honestly,
We have all the consoles, but we don't have a gaming PC. So that is who this is for.
Right.
This is for console gamers who want to play.
Oh. But in 2 years of Stadia, you could afford to buy an Xbox.
An Xbox. How many years is it going to cost me to buy a $2,000?
So you think this will be better than an Xbox?
I think this will be better than a gaming PC.
You're renting a gaming PC, essentially.
You're renting a gaming PC. It gets automatically updated every year. You don't have to buy a new gaming PC every 2 years. And I don't have to play PC games on my 24-inch monitor.
You can play it on a 70-inch. Yeah, yeah, okay.
TV.
Or your phone.
Or my phone.
Or a Chromebook.
All right. Okay.
I did not. 2 weeks ago, I had no idea who this service was for. Now I know it's for me.
It's a gaming PC.
Now,
we should say you have obviously some sort of magical internet service.
I have Sonic.
Yeah, you do, magical internet service.
Which is...
What is the bandwidth you need for 4K? 50 megabits?
I'm not going to have it. I'm probably not going to buy this day one. I'm going to get the free tier.
Right.
And then I'm going to get...
See what 1080 looks
then
like.
Then I'm going to get Ubisoft's streaming service or Activision's streaming service. Okay. Or what? Because that's the next 5 years of gaming is every major gaming platform is going to offer a streaming service.
So in about 6 months when this comes out, Carson's going to stop shaving.
Yeah. Well, I already stopped shaving.
Oh, he already did. He's going to come into work a little bleary.
Yep.
I've been playing Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Okay, I guess that, you know, again, the only issue is your bandwidth. And Google doesn't control that. So it's caps. You know, I have a terabyte and a half cap. And I want to do other things besides playing Stadia 2 hours a day on my internet access. And it's latency and speed. All of those will really be your mileage may vary. You're just going to have to see. But if you do have a magic ISP, if you have a very good ISP with low latency, no bandwidth caps, high speed, this would be better than a gaming PC,
I guess.
As soon
as Sonic gets fiber to my neighborhood, then I'll
be fiber will change,
happy.
Will be transformative. Yeah. Okay.
I have fiber, so I'm all in.
Yeah.
So okay. 5G?
This is a specialized, maybe 5G.
Or Elon.
Elon's magic.
But will 5G work inside?
Yeah, they're gonna have home 5G. Yeah. Because you'll put something in the window. Actually, that's the only kind of 5G you can get right now is Verizon's home 5G or business 5G.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's a different anyway, it's a long story. If next time Stacy's here, I'll let you ask her about it. Google says Chrome is not killing ad blockers. We've never talked about this one. Yes, we have. It's just trying to make extensions safer, guys. Why are you misunderstanding us? Except that the ad blocker I use on Chrome, uBlock Origin, won't work when they update Chrome with Manifest V3. I think it's reasonable to say that Google is doing this to make you safer because it's going to change the way plugins work. Google says there's been a lot of confusion and misconception around both the motivations and implications of this change, including speculation. These changes were designed to prevent or weaken ad blockers. That's absolutely not the goal. It's just a nice side effect. He didn't say that part. But it is a side effect. So maybe they're making... I suspect before it happens, they're going to make some changes to perhaps make it possible. But Gore Hill, who creates uBlock Origin, is obviously not very happy. There will be, and it's interesting, Opera, Vivaldi, Brave, other browsers that use Chromium, the open source Chrome, have said, well, we're not going to implement that part of it. We're not going to do it because they all want to have ad blockers. In fact, Brave is an ad blocking browser. All right, I think we're flagging here. I think we need an infusion of advertising, and then
we've hit our data caps.
Yeah, I've hit my data cap, and then we will get picks and numbers and things like that. But first, a word from Capterra. If you have businesses, and I know many of you do, and you use software in your business, and I know many of you do, and I know many of you using software that is old, to put a finer point on it. It's really old. It is so old that you still have to use IE8 or Windows XP. That's not good. It's time to get some up-to-date software. There is up-to-date, beautifully written, highly functional business software out there for every business, for every possible application. And the place to find it is Capterra.com. 700 categories of businesses, all the big ones, CRM, IT, project management, e-commerce, link management tools, web conferencing. Also, all the little ones, Are you running a veterinary business? Are you a yoga studio? They've got that too. Software for every business. What's great is you can find the software you're looking for, maybe filter it down based on, say, product rating, user deployment, you know, how many users you can have, features, whether it's on the web, on your hard drive, that kind of thing. Is there a free trial? Get a list of filtered suggestions that work for you. What's chemical software? Is that what the Chemical Brothers use to make their albums? What is chemical software? I don't know. But, hey, if you use it, you can get all this here. And then, here's the best part. They have almost 1 million reviews of products by actual users. So every product, you can look at them, compare them side by side, and then read the reviews to know. Oh, that's a CMS, chemical software. It's not for chemists. I get it. I get it. It's actually, you know what? It's fun to go just browse around Capterra. Even if you're not, you know, it's just fun to interest. It's really interesting, all the kinds of software there's out there. And these reviews are very helpful. More than 1,000 new reviews every day. In fact, instead of asking you for money, because Capterra is absolutely free, Capterra says, why don't you leave a review? Pay it forward. We're sharing our knowledge, right? A free directory of business software, all the latest tools, and real reviews from real customers. Wow. Capterra.com/twig. CAPTERRA. Capterra.com/twig. I think you're going to find this incredibly useful. Incredibly useful. Capterra. And it's free. Capterra.com/twig. Capterra is software selection simplified. And we thank you for their support of This Week in Google. Kevin Toefel, I got to pick about Chromebooks.com, Kevin's incredible website, all about Chromebooks. You have a number one fan over here in Jeff Jarvis. And, of course, the podcast, the IoT podcast he does with Stacey Higginbotham, who is now in Seattle. Woohoo.
Yes, she's in Montreal.
She's in Montreal.
Actually, she's in Montreal. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So my pick is more of a public service announcement. And we talked about security today quite a bit and two-factor authentication. In fact, this week, I don't think we got to it on the show notes, but real quick, you can now use a Google Android phone as your two-factor authentication method to authenticate in Google services on iOS devices, which you wouldn't think would be too handy, but a lot of Android phone users have iPads.
Wait a minute. How does that work? Is it NFC?
It's Bluetooth.
Oh, so it's Bluetooth. So your Android phone is a dongle.
In a sense, yeah.
Nice. Yeah.
Right. So whether you use that Android phone as a two-factor authentication bit, or you buy, like I did, I bought the Google's Titan security key, which is like a YubiKey. It's just a specific implementation Google made. Or you use an authenticator app. Definitely use two-factor authentication. Oh, and yes. Here's my horror story as to why. I do another podcast on weekends I've been doing since 2006 with a great guy who writes for ZDNet, Matthew Miller. People may know him on Twitter as Palm Solo because he's a huge Han Solo and Star Wars fan. His phone...
I love the internet.
His phone was SIM hacked, meaning somebody called T-Mobile and convinced T-Mobile that they lost their SIM or whatever and had his phone number transferred to their SIM. Using two-factor authentication text messaging, those folks now have access to all of his Google accounts, as well as his Twitter account. His verified Twitter account is gone. The person has removed 2 years' worth of tweets. He will not be able to get it back from Twitter until they get a response from him from his registered email, which is Gmail, which he doesn't have access to. So my point here is, and he's very upset about this, and he should be, my point here is don't use text codes for authentication if you can help it. Just please download the Google Authenticator or the Microsoft Authenticator app. Use that for one-time codes, a little more secure. Use a hardware key or an Android phone or some other physical device to authenticate everything these days, because it's just getting too easy for people to get these text messages and SIM card hacks and so on, and you lose everything. He's distraught. It's just terrible.
Who is this?
Matthew Miller, Palm Solo on ZDNet. And if you go to Palm Solo, his verified account is still there. But now all the tweets from 2015 onward or gone, the person has deleted them. He's livid, livid. And I mean, he should have taken my advice, unfortunately didn't. You know, he probably had text authentication and such. And it's not his fault that he was SIM hacked. That's on the carrier. You can put, this is another piece of the puzzle, go to your carrier and put a PIN number on your account. Therefore, he didn't have that. If somebody calls and tries to move your phone number to their SIM, they're asked for the PIN code. And chances are they're not going to get that right.
You shouldn't also allow SMS messages for two-factor. Sometimes you have to. My bank. Sometimes you have to. But Google doesn't. And, you know, turn that off. You know, just don't do that because that's dangerous. Right.
Well, and it gets back to the slide, Leo, that you pointed out how two-factor authentication websites has actually, the number of them has decreased for the percentage. It is sad. I cringed when I heard that.
Yeah. And so many banks still allow SMS messages. Now, he was targeted, right? Because you can't, this is not a general purpose attack. Somebody has to take the trouble to get your phone number and then call the, you know, cell phone company, impersonate you, get them to send a SIN out. So it's somebody targeting him.
Correct.
Nevertheless, but that doesn't mean it won't happen to you. It's not a good thing.
How did they get the Gmail? Just because don't you have to have both the password and the text?
Well, that's a good point.
I think you can, if you don't remember your password, one of the ways to get through is text me a code. Right. Exactly. Phone numbers. I mean, we take them for granted, but people use them a little or rely on them too heavily for security purposes, and we can't be doing that anymore.
NIST finally said, "Do not use. It is not safe to use SMS messages for two-factor."
When I sign on to Google from a new device, and it says, "Unlock your phone and say yes, that's me," that counts as two-factor?
It does. It's basically an app-based system. Yes.
So Google offers a huge variety of two-factor solutions. Mm-hmm. I have a YubiKey, which I use. This is the YubiKey. So it's on my keychain. So that way, that's a physical dongle. And then you're going to give it a backup. And so you can print out codes if you want, put them in your drawer. You can use Google Authenticator to generate a six-digit number. The more modern way to do it, which I really like, and Google started using this, is you can have it send a notification to your phone. That's different from an SMS because it's sending it over Wi-Fi or the internet to the app, which the app then pops up a notification and it says, "Did you just log in? Do you want to approve that?" And you say, "Approve." Microsoft and Google both offer.
Which is so much easier, too, than having to put a number in. It's just great. It's very convenient.
I far prefer it. But go into your Google security. I guess I shouldn't show mine because it has personal information in it. But go into your Google, security.google.com. Take a look at how it suggests to secure your account. And if two-step verification is on, make sure that it is not on and allowing SMS. You can say no text messages is not one of them. It shouldn't be a fallback. It shouldn't be anything. Because if it's a fallback, it's the weakest link, and that'll work. And they can simjack you, and it's not just simjacking. Does he know how they got his phone number? There's a variety of ways to do it.
He hasn't told me. I mean, I've had little contact because I don't even know.
He doesn't. Probably is offline.
He's got a new Twitter account temporarily. I've actually asked him things that he would know, only things I've said to him privately, not something I've emailed him or is available online just to verify it was him.
Jesus, that's what a pain in the ass.
Oh, it's crazy. Oh, it's absolutely insane. God.
So there is a couple of things you can do. The problem is that the baseband software in all cell phones is hackable, and it's well known to be hackable. It hasn't been fixed ever. It's been broken forever. And SS7. And so that's one way they can do it. They can kind of intercept messages. The more common way is to call your phone company and say, "Hi, this is Kevin Toefel, and I lost my SIM. Please send me a new one at a new address." And the phone company, because they are, after all, customer service reps, often will say, "Oh, yeah, sure. What's the address now?" Don't use SMS. That's a good reminder. Thank you.
Is Fi any better or worse?
You know, I hope so, because that's the number I use, is my Fi number. I would hope they're smarter. put a pin on it, though. You're right, Kevin. That's a good thing to do, because then at least the customer service rep will say, well, what's your pin? And that would stymie a hacker, I think, in most cases. Jeff, your number of the week.
I was just trying to look up how to put a pin on Google Home.
Just send me your phone number, Jeff. I'll put the pin on.
Yeah, that's
for
right.
You.
Actually, just tell us.
Open the Google Fi app. In the account tab under phone settings, click voicemail.
That's a voicemail pin. You want an authentication pin with support.
They may not offer it.
No,
because they don't have any customer service.
T-Mobile does. In fact, T-Mobile got hacked some time ago, and they sent text messages to many of their users, including me, saying, put a pin on your account now. So I did. Jeff,
Facebook Watch says they have 140 million daily viewers who watch at least 1 minute, but an average of 26 minutes a day, 720 million monthly users compared to 400 million in 2018. So it's growing. I don't know whether Facebook does that include the videos that come by in my news feed?
No. That's a separate channel.
That's separate. So you gotta go to Facebook Watch. Do you go to Facebook Watch?
I don't even have a Facebook account. I did see yesterday an exclusive of something I would have liked to have watched that was only on Facebook Watch, but I can't remember what it was because I can't. So folks, if you want people to watch, exclusive is not a good idea, but Facebook Watch has gotten surprisingly traction. But I guess if you have 2.5 billion users or whatever, it's probably not hard to do that.
Right. I don't really see, it's not being promoted in my news feed. So it's funny. I just don't think to go there. I'm going there right now. Oh, Dodo, no baby deer.
They have Fox News on it, CNN's on it. It's amazing. They have 720 million viewers. That's
monthly.
That's amazing.
And arguing that now the best video of the year is the baby talking to his father.
Is that on Facebook Watch?
It's on Facebook Watch. Yeah, it's everywhere. You've seen that one?
No.
You haven't seen that one?
Oh, no.
See, this is what you're missing.
All right.
Can you find it?
Yeah, I can play it. You want to watch it?
Oh, you do want to watch this. This is
okay.
The best.
This is from YouTube. This is a vertical video recorded apparently with somebody's smartphone. Oh, I you know what? I've seen it without audio.
You got to have the audio.
This is the best.
Okay.
So they're watching.
You work on that, right? Yes. Okay. Did you understand it, though?
Yeah.
No. Okay. All right. Huh? Oh, not this one. This is the grand finale of this.
Okay, the last one?
Yeah, that's the last one. That's what I was wondering. I don't know what they're going to do next season because they did some stuff this time. Exactly what I was thinking. Oh, yeah. Right, don't bring that again. You know what I'm saying? Don't do the same stuff. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, I was like that. Yeah. Yeah. Like, go somewhere else with that, but don't bring it here. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. That's what I said. Like, you know what I'm saying? I was like, what in the world? But don't do that here. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
So the kid's talking sim talk.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really? I thought the same thing. You think a lot alike, huh? That's crazy. Right.
Now, who says the internet's a bad place? Yeah.
It's been watched more than 55 million times.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Shared 1.5 million times on Facebook.
I'm surprised I haven't seen them on Ellen DeGeneres yet. I've
had that conversation a million times. So yes. To me, it's like, well, yeah. Okay, fine. I guess people who don't have kids don't, like it or something. I don't know.
The hard-hearted people, yeah.
I'm a hard-hearted person. It's cute. Cute kid. Cute.
So anyway. It's on that among everything else is on Facebook Watch. People are watching Facebook Watch, and they're
starting to feel left out.
So the bigger thing that's interesting to me. So I think Google has been standing back, kind of saying, Facebook, they're on the hot seat. We're not the same. You know, Google people say to me all the time, don't call us platforms. We are different companies, right? So now YouTube is causing trouble for Google. So they're in the same hot seat that Facebook's put on, and you can't. And then the newspaper industry goes after Google. So now Google's on the hot seat again. So it'll be Google for a month or two, and then it'll be Facebook again, and then.
So this is what you get if you don't have a Facebook account when you go to Facebook Watch, is sign up for Facebook. Original shows, popular videos from producers and creators you love.
Schmuck.
None of these. I've heard of Will Smith. I don't really care about his bucket lists. Steph Curry, okay, great, but I can watch him play basketball too on TV.
Scam, you can't watch Scam without it.
Scam is awesome.
What's Scam?
Oh, we've talked about that like 2 years ago.
S-K-A-M. That's A.M. Yeah,
that's a kind of live teenage soap opera thing.
Why would I want to watch that?
It's good.
Like I said, I got too much stuff on Netflix. I already want to watch thousands of brilliant women, and it has really bad link baity stuff.
Netflix is dark. I tried to go watch stuff on Netflix before I went to Athens. Tried to download some stuff. Man, everything there is depressing and dark.
Yeah, but dark is really good.
You know what?
The German show?
The world is kind of dark right now, Jeff. People aren't really ready to laugh.
Well, it's being made darker by media. What German show? Welche Show, Arsten?
Dark is, Leo, you know this one.
I haven't seen it.
Yo, no, you've seen it. Dark, the German, it's like Stranger Things.
Oh, I did see that one.
Oh, right.
Really? It was the and I watched it at first in dubbed English. I thought, this is the worst show I've ever seen in my life.
Watch it with subtitles.
And then I watched it in German, and I said, I don't understand it, but it's a lot better show.
I think the second season just came out.
Oh, yeah, it was good. It was basically German Stranger Things in German. You would like it, Jeff. But, you know, there just came out today, we were talking about music, the Martin Scorsese's documentary of Bob Dylan's Rolling Thunder Review, which I remember seeing was a seminal moment in my young life in 1975 at the New Haven Coliseum Arena. There's a bunch of good stuff on Netflix. That's not all dark.
Well, it's all everything that's showing me is dark.
Okay, well, maybe then you'll understand my pick of the week. So when you die,
oh good, Leo!
Instead of getting buried in a cemetery,
I saw how I'm going to die this afternoon. By the way, just to hold.
How are you
going to
die?
You know my fear about hate, my hate of heights.
Yes, your height hate.
The glass bottomed observation deck in the building formerly known as the Sears Tower.
Yes,
cracked.
What? I stood there and thought, this is terrifying because you're looking down.
My palms are sweating.
Did it crack and people fell through it? No.
No.
Just has a crack.
Well,
that's not a big
Willis, if you search for Willis Tower, protective layer of sky deck cracks under visitors' feet.
Yikes. And again, this another is my sky fear. High scare at the Willis Tower.
Another sky high scare.
Under visitors' feet. This video was shot on the 103rd floor last night after the ledge's protective layer splintered into thousands of pieces. It actually covers the glass bottom below. The Willis Tower says no one was ever in danger because the protective glass
if it
did
broke.
Exactly what it was supposed to. But try telling that to the mother who was standing on it with her kids.
Oh, it's just the
I was standing on it with my kids and it cracked. I thought I was going to die. But when I do die, I want to be buried in a tree.
There we go now.
Oh my God. It's cracking. It's cracking. And
trigger warning, Leo.
That's actually wild. This is a bridge in China that cracked while people were on it.
Are you still showing it?
Yeah, you could stop now, Karsten.
So Jeff. Jeff wouldn't do what I did in Vegas and jump off the stratosphere.
I'm pretty sure it's video screens.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, it's not real.
No.
It it gives the terrifying experience an extra zing. Zing. Jeff Jarvis.
So that's how I'm going to die. Now what are you going to do with my body? If it survives that long fall, it doesn't just splat into a million pieces.
This is a Silicon Valley.
What are you going to do with it?
A Silicon Valley startup called Better Place Forests. It's betterplaceforests.com. Instead of, and they've already bought, started to buy up old growth forests. One of the things they do when they buy them up is they make sure they'll never be built on ever, because now it's a natural memorial. There's one near us. I'm going to do this. You take your pick of giant redwoods, mossy tan oaks, reverend firs, and more. Find a tree that fits your personality. Choose your forest, make it your own. And then when you kick, they cremate you and they put you in they fertilize the tree with you. And I hope put a little plaque on the tree. I don't know about that part yet.
Until the tree burns down.
Well, it's not. Well, that's,
or dies.
Yes,
falls.
But, you know, everything dies. Whatever. You think that anybody's going to visit your grave in 100 years?
Oh, yes. I'll be famous.
Oh, okay. You'll be like Gouda. People go to visit Gouda's cemeteries.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Jim Morrison.
He was on Twig.
Here's the one I want. It's in Santa Cruz, where I went to high school. It's an 84-acre woods, uninterrupted view. Look at this. Wouldn't you like to be buried there? Well, you're actually buried. I think you're cremated, and then they use your... Here, in case you want to visit it, are some hotels and restaurants nearby.
Silicon Valley.
Let's see what this is. Silicon Valley. So,
is
pricing.
This cremation.
Pick your tree.
I don't think so. No, your pricing is based on your tree's size, species, and location.
Oh, Jesus!
Not cheap. If you want a young tree, up to 70 feet tall. Rising toward the sunlight, our young trees are quickly headed for the canopy. Santa Cruz is $6,400, but Point Arena is cheaper, $2,900. And then they can spread you out other places. Of course, if you want a big tree, Jeff, because you're going to live forever, $16,000.
I'm a big guy.
Yeah.
Because you've got to have a tree that's my size.
Yeah, you know.
Cremation kills, like, most of your benefit for the...
Yeah, they shouldn't really cremate you. They should compost you.
Yeah.
There are composting caskets. That might be the next thing. Did you see that? They spray you with a little mushroom foam.
And you can even include your pets.
Of course you can, because there's plenty of room.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think?
So do they inject you in the tree? What do they what do they do with your...
They just sprinkle you on the tree.
Yeah.
They smear you, your little schmear.
Nellie Bowles wrote about this today in the Times. Better Place Forests. It's cheaper than a cemetery. You don't have to worry about somebody cleaning your grave. They already have a few dozen remains in the soil. They've sold thousands of trees to the future dead. Most customers are pre-need, middle-aged and healthy, decades ahead of finding themselves in the roots. They've raised $12 million in venture capital.
Oh, Silicon Valley is so nuts.
I think this is a good idea.
I'm in as
if your tree dies, they will replace it with the same species.
Oh yeah,
I'm in as soon as they don't do cremation, because this has always been my plan.
To be, you know,
glad it's finally
get the mushroom spray and then just, you know, dig a standing hole and just jump in. Exactly. Customers come to claim a tree for perpetuity, which costs between $3,000 and $30,000, depending on your tree. There's also $970. You could just be in a community tree, cremation not included. Then you get a round plaque in the earth like a gravestone. They dig a 3x2 foot trench at the roots of the tree. They mix your remains in with soil and water, sometimes adding other elements to offset the alkalinity of the bone ash. You know, pets are allowed. Spreading is what they call the ash deposit. The trench is a space. The watering can is a vessel. The on-site sales staff are forest stewards. Get it right. And then here's your available trees. You can go in the forest. See these ribbons? That means you could be buried there. That's a cheap one, right by the river there.
Mm.
Nice.
Location, location, location.
Yeah. Death is a growth industry, says Nellie Bowles.
Why isn't this in Mary Meeker's presentation?
I think this is awesome. Look at the marker.
I think we know why.
Look, and you can even have a little quote. I was spread here.
Yeah, most people I know who've had cremated relatives did this for free, though.
Yeah. You're not supposed to.
They just kind of went to the
tree. You can't. That's not right. You're not allowed. People say, oh, please spread me at Disneyland. You have to sneak in.
Mm-hmm.
This way it's legit. Plus, there's a plaque. I guess you're right. You could have somebody do it.
My mother's in a memorial garden at my sister's church. My sister's a Presbyterian minister. It's a little weird. She kind of walks by mom every day.
Yeah. I'm going to do the mushroom spray, I think.
Well, no, what is this mushroom spray? This is like the Whole Foods mushroom rack thing?
It's a composting casket.
Mushroom.
They turn you into a host.
They call it the mushroom burial suit. It turns dead bodies into clean compost.
See, that would be so much better for the tree.
It would be.
You look good in that, Carson.
The tree would love this.
It would be good. Good
for you. Radar detection too. Apparently,
yeah.
Look at that thing.
Yeah, it's stealth. but it's got little fungi spores in it, there you go. And you don't have to burn it. It's the Infinity Burial Suit. And according to the CDC, it cleans the body of toxins before returning it to nature.
What does that T-shirt say?
Choose the suit.
Infinity Burial. Oh, that's a fun thing to go wearing around town.
Yeah, get the T-shirt. The T-shirt's cheaper than the suit. The suit is $1,500. It comes in black or natural colors.
Who cares what color it is?
I'm gonna have to get the large. Let me just add this. Do you want an infinity burial shroud?
So then you have no coffin at all.
They wrap you in the shroud, stick you in the ground, put a plaque by the tree, and you're done. That's my goal. COEIO.com if you want the Infinity Burial Suit 2. I feel bad for the people who have suit 1.
There's no upgrade.
There's no upgrade. Ladies and gentlemen, what a way to end not only this show, but...
There's no upgrade in death.
There's no upgrade in the Infinity Burial Suit.
One and done. Suit.
Kevin Toefel, thank you so much for filling in for Stacy, who is Montreal conventioning. Kevin is at aboutchromebooks.com, at Kevin C. Toefel on the Twitter. And, of course, you can catch him on the IoT podcast with Stacy every week. Did you do one today?
We actually did one yesterday.
Oh, good.
Okay. Yeah, so just to get her on her way.
We'll look for a new one. Mr. Jeff Jarvis, we love him. He's the Leonard Tow Professor for Journalistic Innovation at the Craig Newmark Graduate School of Journalism at the City University of New York. BuzzMachine.com, at Jeff Jarvis, former TV Guide critic, but always a lot of fun. Thank you, Mr. J. Thank you, Mr. T. Thank you all for watching. We do this show Wednesday afternoon, 1:30 Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC. You can stream it live, audio and video, available at twit.tv/live. If you do that, chat. At irc.twit.tv. That's where all the people watching live hang out. You can also get on-demand versions of this show at our website, twit.tv/twig, or wherever you get your podcast. In fact, subscribe and you'll get it automatically the minute it's available. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll see you next time on This Week in Google. Bye-bye.